78 of Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
I am the real deal.
John Lindemann.
My Iron Man streak continues.
And this week, Guillaume is in Boston for PAX East. And unfortunately, we're not there with him. I don't know what he's doing in terms of podcasting. I know Neil's out there, and I think Zach, two Zachs on our staff are out there. So they might be getting together to do some kind of show. I'm not sure, but it won't be an official panel. But I'm looking forward to see whatever they do. And from hearing that, I'm sure we'll hear from some of them on Connectivity next week and find out what they did at the show. And maybe Guillaume can talk to us, as well about it. But in his place this week, we have Mr. Lewis Pugh.
I am not Guillaume.
No, you're not Guillaume. But you do have a nice accent. Where are you calling from, Lewis?
I am calling from the UK, specifically in Southampton.
All right. Well, and that means he is staying up very late to do the show with us, and so I definitely appreciate that, man. So Lewis is the host of the Infindo podcast, which is a Nintendo site that you should check out. I've known about it for a long time. Used to see a guy every year at E3 from Infindo, and he was really nice. We would always chat. Good guy named Will. So nice to hear that you guys are doing your own show and that you're willing to get out there and be a guest on other shows too. I heard you on Connectivity a couple weeks ago and thought you sounded great, and we needed a guest this week, and you had mentioned that you liked our show and would be interested, and I was like, yeah, man, that'd be fantastic if you could come do it with us.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely happy to be here, and thankfully the battering on Twitter paid off.
No, I'm happy to say yes. And of course, you've got something going on to that you maybe can promote a little bit later, but can you tell us like really quickly about your game? And I want to hear a little bit more about it later.
Yeah, sure. Okay, the very quick elevator pitch is I'm doing a Wii U exclusive game. It's on Kickstarter right now. It's going to be, as I said, a Wii U only eShop release. And it's a 2D open world platformer where you play as a girl called Cora, and she defeats a variety of different enemies and so on, mainly with water-based attacks, the main weapons being dual water pistols. And that's all I'll say for now.
It's not a Mutant Muds clone, is it?
It's not, ironically. Again, I'll go more into it later. The original game was released before Mutant Muds on an iPhone. So if anything, they stole my idea.
Oh, nice. Throwing down the gauntlet. All right. Well, actually, we're going to actually jump off a new business here, and we've got listener mail. Yeah, we've got listener mail coming up later in the show where we will talk at least a little bit about Smash Brothers. But first up, actually, John, I put you first on the list for new business, and you mentioned that you're still incredibly busy with your move and you haven't had time to play anything, but there's something we could talk about.
Yeah. Well, I did get my 3DS back, but, you know.
Oh, that's good.
And wait. What shape is it in?
Well, it got nuked. There's nothing on it, so I haven't even dug into it.
Let me tell you a secret, dude. It's probably not the same one.
I don't even know. Right now, I'm waiting. Before I even touch it, I have this thing about not scratching the screen, so I'm waiting until I get a screen. I already ordered a screen protector from Amazon. I'm super, super anal about that kind of stuff. I do not.
It's a drop of Vita in a bathtub.
This is, yeah, it's a paradox. I live within a paradox, but.
You are indeed a paradox.
Beautiful.
So, yeah.
So, what are we going to talk about instead, John?
Well, I will say that Vita did have a screen protector, for the record.
Oh, good. Did it have a life jacket?
What are we going to talk about? We are going to talk about Tomodachi Life, which was the subject of a Nintendo Direct. Now, I had never seen this. I'd heard about this game in Japan.
So it's a sequel to the DS game, which was huge in Japan.
Okay, and in Japan it is Tomodachi Collection.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, and I had heard about this game, and, you know, every time, you know, whenever I would check sales, you know, the sales charts from Japan, this game is just selling like crazy. So I really, but I'd never really looked into it until this Nintendo Direct, so I really didn't know what it was all about. I knew it was some kind of quirky kind of, you know, Japanese-y sort of thing, but, and so it's, for those that didn't watch the Direct, I mean, from what I gathered, It is a it's a game in which you have all of your Miis, and they basically interact and do things like they fall in they fall in love and they apparently battle over each other's affections and stuff like that.
Just
and,
like real life.
And
this podcast.
And so in this Nintendo Direct, I mean, it showed all kinds of crazy stuff, like, you know, Miis performing in a rock band, performing crazy lyrics.
It's The Sims. I mean, there's
yeah.
It's totally The Sims.
Yes.
Which I didn't even realize. I had never really quite put that together. I'd heard that it was a game where your Miis go out and kind of do weird things, and they talk, and that was the talking was one of the reasons that a lot of people thought this would never come to the West. And I didn't read too much into the European. I know it was released in, I mean, it was announced in the UK. I don't know if it was announced in other countries, because I don't know if they're trying to do this vocalizer thing in other languages. Are you aware of that?
I can confirm that they are. In a very impressive feat, they did this show off that on the European version, you have access to all the different European languages, and that is one of the voice toggles you can set is the actual language itself.
That's incredible. Like
it is.
I wonder if you can choose your languages in the American version too, because if not, the European might be sort of the definitive version. Just because you could mess around with it and hear all the different weird computer voices in different languages.
Yeah, no, I'd definitely have fun just playing around, setting some random Miis up for different languages purely because they do speak in that language, in that robotic voice.
Yeah, that's almost like a bonus feature for Europe. Or maybe they're doing the American one too. It's certainly not something they showed in the Direct. But yeah, they're totally doing that. So this thing has a voice synthesizer in it. You can type out messages and the game will say them out loud to you. And using that, you can write scripts, I think, for things, and you can make the character say all kinds of different stuff. I wonder if it will let you send messages with your Miis when you street pass, because that would be really interesting. You could get into a lot of trouble with that, but because it's text entry-based, they, you know, I'm sure they have a pretty robust filter for trying to keep dirty stuff out of it. And I also bet you probably can't get around it with leet speak and slang and stuff like that, because the system may not recognize that stuff. It may not, you know how to pronounce all that gobbledygook that you would normally use on a text message board like Miiverse to try to get things through the censorship. So maybe you could do that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought this was fascinating. To me, it reminded me so much of those old Talent Maker demos. I think there was a Talent Maker release for the 64DD.
Yes.
So five people owned that. And I just
and
remember
one of them bought Talent Maker.
Right, but I remember videos of that on IGN 64 back in the late 90s, you know, or maybe the year 2000, and I watched those videos all the time. This was like very early in the days of internet video, but they were so funny and so weird, and those guys were clearly having a great time with it, and that was just, you would take a photo of yourself with the Game Boy camera, I think, and then import it into the game through the transfer pack.
The 64, and then it would, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, amazingly
convoluted. How much
plastic
shit can they sell you to make this game work?
Yeah,
it's a disc drive, Game Boy attachment,
exactly.
A Game Boy camera, Jesus.
But it was awesome because you could sort of make these prototypical Miis, because you could take a photo of your face and put it on the Mii, which was really funny. You could also, I'm sure, draw on them. And it would create these weird cutscenes using the characters that you made, and they could be really, really funny. And this is exactly the successor to that. I might have even heard that somewhere along the way, but it hadn't clicked until I saw the video today. And I was like, oh shit, this is great. I totally want this.
You know, I'm sitting around and I just see this start trending on Twitter. I think, oh dear God, why? What in God's name has just happened? And like, immediately, I understood that Nintendo had announced this for Western release, because otherwise, there's not just some grand cabal who suddenly started tweeting about Tomodachi Collection.
No, it's actually been rumored for the past few months.
Yeah, it has
various
been.
Leaks and reports and, you know.
But, like, just seeing, watching the video of it and thinking to myself, holy crap. This is incredibly bizarre.
Yeah.
It does feel, I mean, I'm sure there's a ton of content in it, but it does feel like the kind of thing that should be software on the 3DS.
I mean, to me, I would look at it as sort of those Street Pass games that they sold last year.
Yeah.
It's more expansive than any of those, and I could see the price being higher than those were, because those were about $5 a piece, weren't they?
Yeah, it seems weird as a retail product.
Yeah, to me, this looks like something like a $15 or $20 game that you download, and becomes essentially like a new, yet another portal for your Miis that you gain through Street Pass or over the internet with friend codes, and that you can populate and do something with your Miis. It's really not that different from the other ones. The fact that they're charging $35 for this in the US, it strikes me as weird, because I'm not sure this is a game in any kind of traditional sense, not even nearly as much as something like Animal Crossing, which actually has goals and a progression and persistence in a world that you help create. I mean, it's a casual game, maybe, but it's very much a video game. This, to me, seems more like an app.
It's like a digital toy.
Yeah, which is great, and I'm totally willing to pay for it, but not $35.
Well, it seems to me more like it's more like Nintendogs to me, where that's the first thing I questioned was the depth of it. Like, once you get past all of the neat little funny things that your Miis can do, will you hit a wall where there's just nothing else to really do with the game?
Or the question is, will you ever see all of that stuff? Like, it's possible that they have so much in here. Because the production value is so low. I mean, it's really like one of those weird macro type things that I think there was one that was really popular in Japan for a while, where it was like these two weird cartoon characters who were done in CG, and they would kind of it would basically crank out a computer generated, like, pre-rendered cutscene of these two characters, but you could type in what you wanted them to say and
you gave them general screen direction, and they just sort of rendered
right.
It.
Yeah, and it would animate that, and then it would spit it out onto a YouTube video. And this was really popular for a while. It seems like that to me. Like, it's more about creating the tool, and I don't know that you necessarily have to hand make a ton of content. I'm sure there is quite a bit of that, but it's not like, you know, I think a lot of the process, I think a lot of the game is procedural, is what it looks like to me, as well as user created. So, I don't know. Whereas Animal Crossing is so handcrafted, you know, I mean, it's just chock full of thousands and thousands of things that, you know, an army of artists created. So to me, that seems, not to mention that I think it is more interactive, Animal Crossing. You know, it is much more a game, like I said. But this was much more appealing to me than I expected when I turned on the video. It's immediately funny. You know, the direct had a funny, in America at least, it had a funny presentation with Bill Trennan, where he's kind of playing this overly, you know, excessively gravitas newscaster doing a news report about this game. And it came across to me actually as like one of those VHS tapes they sent out back in the 90s for Star Fox. And you know what I mean? Had that kind of like really hokey, like, we did it in the back of the office kind of feel to it.
It felt like they taped it this morning.
But clearly had put some thought into it. You know, I had written out this pretty elaborate script and had paired it up with a lot of videos that I'm sure took a lot of effort to produce all those different skits and to find the funniest ones. It really is pretty hilarious. I mean, it's like string after string of just these nonsense little cutscenes that the game has output, and it's featuring people like Bill Trennan and Reggie Fils-Aimé and Satoru Iwata and Shigeru Miyamoto, and they're going out on dates and they're living in the same apartment and having arguments, and they're singing songs to each other on the beach, and all of them have these hilarious robot voices.
I know.
Effect is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, it's like the whole thing is auto-tuned. It just completely cracked me up. I couldn't get enough of hearing them talk.
Anyway, yeah, Tomodachi Life, I was surprised at how appealing it was, but I'm going to have to wait for some kind of price drop or something. It doesn't seem like a good deal to me, but it's intriguing nonetheless. I'm certainly amused by what I saw. I'd like to see more of that. But, you know, I mean, I like Freaky Forms a lot, which has a lot of the same appeal, frankly. It may be a less sophisticated product, but it really kind of generates the same kind of goofy, hilarious nonsense that this game does, and that game was like $8 when it first came out.
Yeah, until they released the premium version.
Yeah, which is now still not that much. It's not a full price game.
Some incomprehensible reason they made a premium version of that game.
That's right. I wanted to tell my side on the European direct. We had Mr. Shibata as the Mii news reporter, the newscaster. But I did like how they had the narrative, as it were, going through this Nintendo direct, and the skits they were doing with Mr. Iwata. I thought was partly brave and just partly very comedic in terms of them trying to get some sort of interview or some sort of story out of him, and he's just playing with his cat or singing in the bath or doing something, which I assume he should be doing something more important. But yeah, I was very impressed with this direct. I mean, I need to see more of it because I'm still not sure what it is. I'm not sure how these like scenarios are going to be structured in any way. I mean, you can obviously make some funny stuff with it. And I mean, it looks like it's a good part Sims and a good part Animal Crossing, and it's obviously picked up well in Japan. So it must have some good stuff in it. So I'm eagerly awaiting just some more details. I mean, it would be the perfect game to have a demo, but I don't think it will. I would really like to get my hands on it before a purchase, but I think it's just so weird that it might be worth, at least in my opinion, just to go out and pick it up, because it's kind of unlike anything else. It's really a very odd Nintendo game. It's as you were saying, it's kind of like those demos they were showing back kind of in the Nintendo 64 era.
I kind of want to have it for E3. Like, I kind of feel like that's where this thing will be completely, completely stupid and pointless and amazing. Because I don't have any work to do while I'm there, so I just feel like this is the opportunity to just push the limits of auto-tuned stupidity to their absolute maximum.
In all your free time at E3.
Yeah, all that time I'm not sleeping.
So, yeah, Tomodachi Life. I agree with you, Lewis. I'd like to hear more. I'm especially curious as to what level of customization you have over these scenes. You know, I mean, is this kind of like Mad Libs where you just kind of plug in two or three things and it does all the rest for you? Or maybe you have the option to really write out the entire script and choose the setting and kind of make your own dumb karaoke video? Because I think it would be really fun, like, to get you know, all the guys from the podcast and try to create a scene where they're sitting around a table doing a podcast, or maybe even it's cutting, you know, maybe they're in their own remote locations and it's like cutting back and forth as they talk, and you kind of could write like a little goofy fake podcast script. Like that kind of thing seems really fun to me. So
yeah,
I'm curious about it, but I don't know how interactive it is.
It would be funny if you could share that stuff too. I don't know. If you'll be able to share it.
I mean, the game's been out in Japan for a while, so I'm sure if we really sit down, we could probably find some good video that gives a good demonstration of this.
Yeah, we could probably figure this out. But yeah, I'm still confused whether it is more of a scripting thing, or I also had part of the impression that you just give your Mii's personalities and they just go off and do their own thing and you just kind of watch and see what happens.
Right. Like, influence slightly. That's sort of the vibe I got. It's just sort of they go off and be stupid on their own.
Yeah, I just want to know if we can recreate episode 103 within Tomodachi Life.
If it's possible, it will happen.
Yeah. You take the 3DS and you throw it down a flight of stairs. You have recreated 103 in Tomodachi. What's curious to me is they actually kept the only part of the name that wasn't in English.
Right.
They said, no, we're going to figure this out. They dropped Collection and made it Life. Collection would have worked just fine because it's a pretty accurate description. And then kept the Japanese word for some reason that I don't quite comprehend.
Well, it seems a very Japanesey game, so I think it will work.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely... And yeah, the game is super Japanese. We're in Hatsune Miku territory here. I guess I'll start with Rusty's because that's probably what is most relevant to the show. So Rusty's Real Deal Marketing Experiment number one. The 3DS eShop, I mean, it's not even a free to play. It is a weird experiment in marketing in which you haggle with a dog to buy baseball minigames. We've talked about it on the show before. You know, there's plenty of content out there to describe what this is. I'm going to describe the experience of playing it instead. So, essentially, the game is it's just a collection of baseball minigames that you buy individually using real-ass dollars to pay for this thing. And in order to do so, you communicate with this dog who owns a baseball store that's floundering and his wife has left him and he's got 10 kids to feed. It's real weird. And you are subjected to a litany of puns and all kinds of just madness in order to play what are really fairly simple baseball game mini games around like timing your swing and catching fly balls and just stuff like that that get real insidiously hard in their latest stages. And I mean, they're real fast. They're kind of like WarioWare micro game style. I mean, they may take at most 10-15 seconds, real quick, real heavy emphasis on things like score attack. And really, it's just you just clear one level, you go to the next one, you clear that level, you go to the next one, and just work your way through 25 each or so in each game you've paid for. It's the writing is funny. Like I said, it's way over the top on some puns and things where you're just like, all right, chill. Treehouse needs to chill real bad right now. The very first one, basically, he's saying, look, if you don't buy a game, my kids are going to starve. And I need you to take one of my kids because I can't afford to feed them. I mean, that is the intro to the game. You have adopted one of his smart-ass puppies because he can't afford to feed them. It's pretty messed up. And, like, his wife's left him. Things are real weird. Like, right now, so I've only seen the first one, the first game buy. All I know right now is they tease the second one, and his nose, he smells something. And then right now, the icon for the story is there is a smoke pouring out of the back of his store, so I assume it's on fire. It's like, this is real weird. This is kind of a dark place. I didn't expect it to go. When we first talked about this game on the show, because I can't remember who it was that wrote something about it for the site, I mean, just on face value, it does feel real shady. It's like, hey, if you're not good at haggling, guess what? And it's weird to haggle with dialogue trees. I think as a person-to-person haggling, I think, you know, we accept that as just part of the cost, part of doing business. But I think when you're haggling with a computer that really wants you to do this very specific dance to get the best price, it feels real weird. Now, granted, just playing through, I mean, I've bought one and I have absolutely just worked my way through the whole thing. I have a ton of these discount tickets. They don't require any haggling whatsoever. I just go up there and say, I want my thing half off. And that's it. I get a half off, and we're done. And then continue to haggle to drive it down more. But it's, you know, there are real, you know, one-time use items that will do the same effect. Even if you suck at haggling, you still have some options. And, in fact, Rusty's Kid is an item during the haggling process to help you get better rates. It's a real strange experience. I'm kind of captivated by it. I feel like it's taking this sort of in-app purchases in a direction that feels way less exploitive than a lot of times you get the feeling coming out of it. At the same time, it's kind of a weird, like, buffet style, just buy what you feel like having and eat up. It's great. I don't know that this is something you could replicate. I feel like this is kind of a one-time only deal. I feel like if you did it a bunch of times, it would lose any of the charm that kind of makes it work. But I think it was a real interesting thought experiment that came out of Kyoto to just like, all right, how can we really dip our feet in this whole buy what you feel like getting sort of in-app, just make gamifying the whole process of buying additional content. I think in a lot of times buying content, you just go into a menu, you scroll through a list of things you can buy. You know, if there's like a season pass, you get all the ones that don't buy this if you have season pass. It's a real just, it's like ordering off of a menu. It's just a thing you do to get to the content. Whereas this, I mean, they straight up turned buying additional content into a game, which is weird. And I think that's obviously something that they are going to continue to attempt to do. I don't think that this is the mechanism with which they can do it a bunch of times, but I think that ultimately, if spending the money is part of the fun, which is kind of like a weird thing to say, but if even spending money on the game is part of the joy you get out of it, there's obviously an immediate positive feedback and re-engagement on spending your money. So for them, this is actually probably a successful strategy that I would expect we're going to see some kind of continuance of in other formats. That was a lot of words. I apologize. So, I mean, I don't know if you've got any thoughts you want to throw in on the real deal.
On Rusty?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what his last name is. It's bad.
Oh, Sluggy. Slugger, I think.
Yeah, Rusty Slugger, because he's a retired baseball player.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah. This game's full of that. That gives you kind of a vibe of how this game is written. I mean, it really is everything is part of the package, even like menus.
Yeah.
The game could see, I mean, they take some shots at themselves in the writing.
Nintendo with the 4DS, yeah.
With the 4DS, yeah, and it talks about how it's better because it has an additional DS or something like that. Or no, it's better because there's a 4 in front of it, I think is what they say.
Right.
I mean, there's some self-parody here. It's
The 4DS thing is really funny. It reminded me of a retro game challenge because when you start
it's exactly the same. Yep.
Yeah, the characters just jump into the system and they become absorbed by it. And then you're playing the mini games. And then when you're done, it spits you back out into this room. And it also spits out all the items that you want. And they're physical objects that then you can go take to Rusty and give him to cheer him up and try to encourage him to give you a discount and to solve his problems in the story.
It's straight up. They straight up cribbed Retro Game Challenge there. I mean,
yes.
They were all over, including the fact that the games come on Super Famicom cartridges.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were all over it.
And I think the fact that you play as your me in this game is nice because it does make you feel like you're involved with the story and that,
yep,
you know, these characters are talking directly to you because you see your face, your character on the screen there. And yet they've done it in such a way that it didn't keep them from creating new original characters to showcase here. And I think those characters are fun. I really like the writing in this game. I think the baseball stuff is surprisingly fun for me. And it is very much Rhythm Heaven or WarioWare style stuff. And so that trumps any relation it might have to actual baseball, which I think is tenuous at times.
I like that that your opponents in this game, the people who pitch and hit that you're fielding or swinging at, are – it's the head. The head is that Nintendo pitching machine from the early 80s. And the body is a guy in a suit.
Yeah.
It's real weird. I mean, this game has a real bizarro sensibility about it that I think is incredibly disarming.
I wouldn't be surprised if this was done by the WarioWare Rhythm Heaven team.
I wouldn't either, actually.
It is. I mean, it's very much of that style, which is why I like it. And I think the price is right, you know? I mean, even if you buy absolutely everything, and probably not everybody will, but even if you did, it's still not that expensive. I mean, you could spend, I guess, $40 on it, but you'd have to be an idiot because the game actively tries to get you to pay less than the full price for those games.
I don't even think you can pay the $4.
It would probably make fun of you if you did.
Oh, it does.
That is the attitude of the game. I think it would actually be like, what the hell's wrong with you? You could have paid way less than that.
So I had him down to $3 and said, all right, I'll pay it. And his kid jumps in and is like, no, he'll break. Just keep pressing. And I'm like, all right, sure, game, I'll give you less money.
It makes you feel like you don't have to pay more as a tip to the developer or because you're worried about saving items to use on later ones or anything weird like that. It's like the game wants you to pay the lowest price because then it knows that it can get its hooks into you and that you will continue to pay the lowest price one by one until you've bought everything that they have to offer. And I think they would be very happy to get $15 out of every person who downloads this. And I think they'll get it from a lot of people because for me, I've already bought 4 or 5 of them. And I'm getting to the point where it's like the games that are left that I don't have yet, I'm not even really sure if I want them. But I do kind of care about the story and I want to see that keep going. And the price is down to like $1.50. And it's like, $1.50. What do I care? You know, like it takes 2 seconds to buy it, and then I get to keep playing. So it's just microtransactions, but they're wrapping it into the narrative in a really meta way that is also just so direct and honest that it's kind of okay. You know, it's like, look, the game is about you buying microtransactions, and we're going to make that a lot more fun than you thought possible.
Right. I think the fact that the game is cheering you on to get a better deal is actively encouraging it. And when you get the best deal, his kid comes out and is like, yeah, good job.
Yeah.
Go you.
Like, you won. Now pay me.
He's Doc Lewis-ing it over in the corner. And you realize that this – I mean, you know, I took a step back because I've been working on this long-suffering piece on gamification. And this is – I mean, that's straight up what they did here. They made this a game. And you win. You can win this game. And it wants you to win – because that means you probably had fun in the process. And it makes you – and I think, A, it makes you more susceptible to buy additional content because you're having fun buying content. But I think it also will help predispose people in the future who play this game to explore buying additional content in their products.
Because they hear people talking about it. It's such an odd experience. Like, this sort of thing, I don't know if this works more than once. You know, I don't know if this is something they can continue to do.
I don't think they can do this one again, but I think they can continue to make a game out of this kind of stuff.
In different ways, you know. Yeah. I think they're incentivizing a certain economic behavior in an odd way. And it's probably one of the smartest business things I've seen them do in a while, maybe just because I interact with it so directly. But to me, it feels very savvy, and it plays into their strengths.
Yeah, I don't see that anybody else could pull this off.
Right.
This is absolute, and they've been kind of limping in this direction the whole time. I mean, you look at I can't remember what
the bunny in the plaza, you know.
Oh yeah. Oh, he's straight up the same deal. He's not gonna, you don't have to negotiate though. He wants to give you a deal. He's your broker back there. But you have what are those, the collections that they've put out? Put out one in December, there's another one coming out. The minigame collections are based on NES games. NES Remix,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those are the same kind of deal. There's a big ass icon to go buy these games on the virtual console. Just right there. They're engaging you. That one's, it's a bit less direct, but that button is big. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to miss it. This is a kind of an end around attempt at engagement.
Well, I mean, you have to look at how Nintendo is really coming at the problem, because they're one of the few companies that actually kind of doesn't like this, and they're trying to do it in ways that doesn't annoy people. Unlike, you know, I mean, they've looked at the models that are out there for, you know, for MTX, like, you know, iOS and Android and stuff like that, and they've seen what annoys people and what people don't like, and they're trying to actively kind of combat that. So really, they're probably one of the only companies out there that's actually looking at it that way, that's not trying to be blatant.
Sorry, what is MTX?
Microtransactions.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Industry terms, Johnny. Come on. We're supposed to be professionals.
Sorry, I don't read Variety.
I kind of need to blow up a big part of the article I'm working on, because it's sort of, I need to reorient my thinking, because I think they're one step ahead of where I thought they needed to get. I mean, I knew about this game, and I'd read a lot about it. I don't think I understood how many angles they were approaching making this whole buying additional content enjoyable.
To me, it's much less cynical than I was expecting. And yet, in a way, on a deeper level, it might actually be more cynical than I was thinking. Like, I just think it's kind of nefarious, but mostly it feels nefarious because they're doing such a good job of it. Because it actually, I'm wary. Like, I actually know what this game is doing going into it, and right. It still worked on me because it's done at such a high quality
you
level.
You feel, it's not like when you feel manipulated from microtransactions or something like Dungeon Keeper.
I was going to say Puzzle and Dragon. Didn't you try that?
But you could still play that game pretty well without paying any money.
Oh, so that's actual free-to-play. This is more like, it's a very small demo that you get for free. It's a subset of one of the games. Right. And it's basically, I played through that in like 2 or 3 minutes. And it's like, okay, time to pony up.
Right. I mean, they force you to go to the room.
They make it part of the tutorial, is you learning to do business with this guy. And of course it ends when you pay him your $2.
Right.
And then you're off to the races. Now you're in the loop. It's brilliant stuff. And it's actually a legitimately fun game. And that's why it doesn't bother me, I guess.
Yeah. If the game wasn't fun, it wouldn't work.
Right.
Cause you'd say, great. I, the haggling's fun, but if this game's not much fun, there's no reason for me to buy any more of it.
Yeah, they've made it very hard to say no.
Yeah, also I think a reason why it does work is they don't try and hide the money transactions with things like coins and such. You are dealing with real money.
Yeah, I mean, he tells you, hey, this is going to cost you real money.
And so I think it's just a bit more honest with the gamers.
They might have done that to protect themselves from angry parents or something like that, but actually, I think it just makes it more appealing. I just think it's just more honest, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at something like Xbox Live. What did Xbox Live? What did everybody hate about it? Was the fact that they used these Microsoft Space Bucks that nobody ever really knew
that don't translate to anything.
Yeah, they don't. You know, there's like
a dollar is 80 cents. Stop
yeah,
it.
I mean that stuff is, and that's why you know everybody really liked PSN was because you just got charged real money that you understood.
Well, and the same thing with Wii points and DSiWare points and all that crap.
At least that was 1 to 100. I mean the Microsoft 1 to 80 was the worst. Because you're like, wait, it's 480? What is that? That's $6? What? Is it 7?
And a lot of free-to-play games do that now. You know, a lot of games have their own built-in currency just for that one game. for the same reason. I mean, it's really taking advantage of people. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like I guess what it comes down to with Rusty is that if I'm going to be taken advantage of, I want it to be done creatively. Yeah. And as long as they do that, I guess I'm okay with it. I mean, I wouldn't have thought so, but as I play it, I find that I'm perfectly fine with it. They validated my my purchasing pattern on this game so much and so hilariously, so charmingly, that I'm okay to just keep doing it, even though I know exactly what's going on.
Right. I'm being taken advantage of, but it's okay.
But I'm shocked that it's working, but I'm also not pissed off about it. So,
oh, sorry. Has anyone heard this theory that Rusty's Real Deal Baseball is essentially Nintendo just practicing the what they described in their financial report, where they're going to introduce a system at some point where the more games you buy, in terms of real Nintendo games, you'll be able to get them at discounts. And there's some similarities to what happens inside Rusty's Real Deal Baseball. Do you reckon anyone thinks that they would use that to potentially use that in real term of actually selling you games and later on they get cheaper?
They already sort of do with the Wii U reward points if you didn't buy the nerfed version. Because effectively, the more games you buy, yeah, the more points you get to spend. But it's so much more explicit in this case.
Right.
The actual retail price drops. I would say that strategy they were talking about when they said it, he was thinking about this game. Because this game had just come out in Japan at that point. I mean, this is the game he was talking about. And, yeah, Judge Johnny Scott, if your price keeps dropping, then, yeah, this is a situation where your real-ass money keeps coming in, even though the amount you have to spend is going down. I would expect that we will continue to see that in their microtransactions. Because they constantly, when you buy microtransactions from them, and we've gone through this for about 5 or 6 games now, Nintendo-published games, they're constantly trying to give you ways to spend less money to get the same experience. I mean, you had like the rental system in Wii Sports Club where you could say, I don't really want this game, but I know for a fact that my uncle likes to play Wii Golf, so we're just going to spend $2 and have it for today.
Well, they had the level packs and New Super Mario 2 and Fire Emblem. They did in Japan. They had the karaoke service that launched with Wii U, where you can buy like 24-hour passes to use unlimited, or you can buy packs of songs, or you can get a monthly subscription.
Yeah, they're constantly trying to give you ways to just spend less money and get the experience,
which makes you want to give them more money. It's really brilliant.
Oh, well, they know what they're doing. They're not dumb.
Yeah, and I think it's really it's a strategy born out of their current situation, which is that they are relying on a smaller user base of people to keep them going right now. And in the case of 3DS, you could say that they're maybe biding their time until that system, you know, eventually reaches sort of what they consider critical mass, you know, for the lifetime of the system. And maybe they're just kind of waiting for that to happen. And in the case of Wii U, I mean, I think the writing's on the wall there. They know this system is not going to be a huge hit. They have to keep it going, and they're trying to find ways to get more money out of the people who already have it. And they're trying to keep us engaged, because what they really dread is not just that they can't sell more Wii U systems. What they really dread is that the people who they've already sold them to stop using them, which happened en masse with the Wii, right?
Right.
And they cannot afford for that to happen on Wii U, because they're not going to be making money on hardware sales to Kingdom Come like they might in a really long-term cycle. They've sold probably a large percentage of the Wii U's that they're ever going to sell, I would say. I'm not going to say the majority, but a big chunk of it has already been sold, and the price probably isn't coming down because of the volumes that we're talking. So they've got to make money on software sales, and they need to extract a lot of software sales out of the people who do have the system. And so they're going to have to get pretty creative about this, and they've got to be very, very careful to do it in such a way that they don't piss us off and drive us away, which is so easy to do when you're dealing with microtransactions and other kind of weird economic gadgets of the modern age. And which they've railed against many times, as was mentioned earlier. And they know the perils of doing that.
They are one of the companies that really needs to keep their image pristine, because it's a big part of what they sell on. They sell on the name, and it's important that they not sully themselves. You have a company like I mentioned Dungeon Keeper because it's the most egregious example of microtransactions I've ever seen. I mean, it's worse than the RPGs that got ported to iOS, where you had to keep buying things just to play them. And they see that what that does to a brand's image. You know, if people feel like they're being exploited, if their overriding sensation is I'm being exploited.
Well, it's like that version of Tales of Phantasia where they charge you for save points and then they cranked up the game's difficulty like way higher than the original.
It's such it's so important that they maintain a sense of this ideal that Nintendo's above that. They won't do this. I mean, yeah, if they thought they could get away with it, they probably would. But they know that if they were to do anything that even remotely whiffed of that kind of exploitation, it would be disastrous for them. So they have to, if they want to do microtransactions, they have to do things like this. They have to make them real tangible. I don't know that I've seen a Nintendo-published game where the microtransactions weren't something relatively substantial when you get them. The Fire Emblem levels were actually really fun. They're really cool levels.
Hey, New Super Luigi on Wii U is, I think, great. I think it's a fantastic value.
But that's not even a microtransaction. That's like an old school PC add-on.
It's an expansion pack, but the amount of content you get for $20 is very impressive.
Oh, it's very impressive. I mean,
That's why no one really complained about it. It was like, oh, cool, more Mario. Yes, please, I want that. You know, and for the price that they're charging, it was fantastic.
Even
so,
the new Super Mario Bros. 2 add-on levels were really, I mean, they were stupid, but they were sort of like this delightful.
They're very ROM hacky, weren't they?
Oh yeah, they were like top tier dumb shit, but they were hilarious in that. Like, I mean, they were some of the dumbest things I've ever seen Nintendo make, and it was beautiful. So I didn't like New Super Mario Bros. 2 that much. My favorite part was playing it with somebody who was just making fun of me for being terrible at it, so I could hand it over to her and make fun of her for being terrible at it. But those add-on levels, I enjoyed more than the main game because they're so stupid. And they knew that. So they cranked up the coins to 11, they cranked up the stupid to 12. And, I mean, I feel like they're very aware. They're incredibly self-aware. And in part, they have to be because they railed on this stuff for so long that they need to be real careful when they do it.
And they know that they're dealing with their most valuable and most hyper knowledgeable customers.
Right.
You know, they're selling this stuff to, even on 3DS especially, a small percentage of the people who are going to buy that game in the first place will ever mess around with the DLC. But the ones who do, I think for the most part, know what they're doing. They know what they're looking for. They keep up on the news. You know, and they're generally, you know, they're smart consumers.
They're people listening to the show.
Right. I mean, they're pretty hardcore fans. And so Nintendo needs to show them respect and deal with them, you know, in an adult way, in a way that seems fair and fun. And I think they're doing an excellent job of it lately. I really do. So, I'm excited to see what comes next from all this. I'm a little afraid, but I think I'm excited too.
Like I said, we talked about this game like it was going to be, oh, this is exploitive as hell. But having seen it now, having experienced it myself, it's a really clever. I mean, it's not a great game, but it's really clever, and it gives me the sense that there are people there at that company who get it, who get it. They don't just get microtransactions; they get where the industry is going, and still get what Nintendo prides itself on, what they're about.
Well, it's pretty obvious that they've taken the time to actually analyze microtransactions and kind of see what goes wrong with them in order to even come up with a scheme.
Yeah, I mean, they got in the game super late. 3DS, it was their first system they did them on. I mean, other people had some weird shit on Wii, where you, with the red logo, paid services. But I mean, they came in real late and they did their homework, and it seems like they're getting better at it with each iteration.
Right.
I mean, Wii Sports Club offers a ton of options. This is even weirder and more, you know, really finely tuned mechanics of selling you digital crap.
I thought they handled Wii Fit U very well. I mean, they treated it, even though it's across systems, they know that if you're like a regular Wii Fit user, even if you do have a Wii U, they know that you can totally do that on your Wii U because it's backwards compatible. So they had to find a way to incentivize you to get the new version. And they knew that a lot of the people who would be willing to buy a Wii Fit U, especially on a small user base, are the people who already have played another version, who already have a balance board, who already have a lot of the content that's in that game. And so they sold it as basically an upgrade rather than as a full retail price product. And essentially the only cost to you was to go buy the pedometer. Now the pedometer is overpriced for what it is, but considering that for a while there, it unlocked the actual game itself that you didn't have to pay extra for, and you could use the same balance board you've already got. That is a really smart awareness and realism about who your audience is and how to get them to spend money on something that they might initially think is kind of not really worthwhile. You know, but they're finding the right price, and that's so critical, especially in America. Is extremely price sensitive here. I don't know about you guys in the UK, Lewis, but in America, we're so price sensitive, and Nintendo is getting really good at targeting what people think is a fair and reasonable price for what they're getting out of this digital content primarily. And I think they're doing a much better job of it than a lot of other companies are.
I think we spend a lot of time on the show critiquing them about what they're bad at. And there is a lot of things that they have blind spots on. But I think ultimately one of the things they get, and we've edged around this. I mean, John and Johnny's 3DS stories are pretty good examples. They do treat their customer with a certain amount of respect.
Yeah.
This seems to be pretty deeply ingrained in the fiber of who they are. That, you know, our customers are really important. We need to treat them well.
Yeah, I would say they always try to do right by the customer.
And they're being real creative with it on this stuff. And I think, you know, we talk about all the problems they have as a company. We talk about the problems the industry has. I think we spent a lot of time on this, but I think it's important that we did, because this is the kind of stuff that will be important for them going forward and important for how they interact with us. And I expect we'll see a lot more of this. They're still going to have their big disc games that are, you know, they are what they are. There's not going to be any kind of major DLC push for them. But I think you're going to see, when they talked about having these teams that make these small kinds of projects, this is the kind of stuff they're talking about. These things that manage to continually produce a certain amount of income over, you know, a prolonged period of time. This is the kind of stuff that can make those small projects really work out well for them.
And yet they've mostly done it without monthly subscription fees, which they've very often in the past have said that they don't like. They've done it without charging for their online services ever, which not even Sony can say now. And they've done it in a way that, what's the best way to put this?
It's distinctly them.
It is distinctly them. And I'll say again, it's getting better at an increasing rate. I think their smartness about this, they're learning these lessons. They're not only catching up in some aspects of the online world, especially the way that they get people to spend money, okay? But they're not only catching up to their competitors, they're surpassing them. They're getting better even faster than the other guys are. And those guys are learning lessons too, but Nintendo has really accelerated the pace of how smart they're being about this stuff, I think. And I think they're moving towards something in the future that is pretty exciting, and it might be the future of the company.
I will say, because I know we probably need to wrap this whole
conversation
up. Yeah,
we've gone pretty long on Rusty's baseball.
We really turned it into a feature topic, is what happened here. What it makes me real curious about, and excited is not really the word I'd look for here, although I wrote extensively about topics, maybe I should be. It really makes me feel like all this stuff is really going to inform what they have planned with this third platform quality of life thing.
Bingo.
Because this is where they could really let the rubber hit the road. They're not constrained by existing hardware or existing kind of concepts of how software should be sold. They could basically do whatever they want. And this is exactly the kind of marketing and sales approaches and this kind of continual engagement stuff that could potentially be really impactful to a more diverse audience than the hyper-informed consumer that tends to buy DLC. I'm not going to say this is them practicing for that, because I don't think it is, but I guarantee you these lessons that, as Johnny says, they've been accelerating their learning process, all that stuff's getting fed back to that other arm of the company.
Yeah, well, if I can wrap this up with one more thought, sorry, I'm going to take the last word on it, but I feel like there's a potential for whatever the quality of life platform is to become a sort of test bed for these ideas, for them to try even more extreme things that and do it on an audience who is not nearly as invested and isn't nearly as sensitive to these topics as gamers are. There'll probably be relatively little overlap between they hope so, I think. You know, they're hoping to get new people to buy this new product that they're working on. But if they can use that as kind of their test area to try weird things economically and with the internet, you know, and with the way that people interface with this stuff. I'm not talking about incorporating technological aspects of that back into their gaming business, but maybe they can try out some of these ideas like we're talking about.
The psychological part of talking to a consumer.
Yep, which they have a weird... We have a weird relationship with Nintendo, James and John and Lewis. I mean, I think there's something to be said for them resetting and getting to talk to a new class of people, not class, that sounds terrible, but a new group of people, a new demographic or whatever, depending on what they're targeting. I don't know what they're targeting, but I think it's a chance for them to talk to people for the first time, people who don't have really any strong association with Nintendo. And I wonder if the word Nintendo will be quite so prominent on whatever this new product
is. Well, it wasn't when they did this with the Wii, and it was the same kind of philosophy. They were trying to target a whole new population. So that system is not the Wii or Nintendo Wii or the Nintendo Wii. It is just Wii. The Nintendo logo appeared on the right side of the console, white on white, because it was recessed. I mean, they did not... it was their system, but it was its own thing. I fully expect you'll see the same kind of marketing branding at play here.
Well, let's move on from this. Certainly is fascinating material, though, and you know, I bet we'll hear from some people who've had their own experiences with Rusty, and I wonder if
there come to Rusty moments.
Well, I wonder if there's going to be a variety of opinions on it. You know, I wonder if different people have different levels of tolerance for this kind of thing, or if the charms of the game don't work on you, you're not going to keep buying it. You know, you're going to stop early. So it's not going to snag everybody. But anyway, I did want to talk very briefly about Mario and Luigi because I did get it on Wii U on the GBA Virtual Console. And we didn't talk about it last week. We talked about all these other games. But Mario and Luigi was one of my favorite GBA games for sure. I haven't played it in at least 10 years. So it's weird going back to it now. I am still finding the writing to be very... funny, very amusing, and full of a lot of weird clashing styles. They're not afraid to kind of mix it up with the style of the localization as you talk to different characters. And they've created some like really memorable personalities here. The battle system is pretty simple but fun. It is neat that you still control the characters independently during battle, although it does make the menus a little confusing sometimes. I don't think the bros attacks are much fun at all to do, which is maybe one reason I didn't like the sequel to this game, which relied very, very heavily on those. In general, I'm enjoying the action. The part that I've struggled with a little bit and is not as fun as I remembered was the kind of platforming stuff that you're doing around the environment. It's very clever, and the game gives you very intricate levels to kind of navigate around. Like, there's a lot of platforming. Surprisingly for an RPG like this, but much more than anything you would see in a Paper Mario game. And I think that's not necessarily a good thing because the view is sort of isometric. And so any kind of platforming in that camera view is pretty tricky. And in this game, it's especially tricky because you are controlling these characters at least somewhat independently of each other. And the controls get pretty complex because the GBA didn't have many buttons, and they're trying to give you completely independent control of two different characters with a total of about four buttons. So the controls are just a little convoluted, and when they give you very complex environments that require kind of a long chain of different special moves in order to complete, this, you know, like special jumps and using the hammer to drill one person down and then they pop back up or whatever. This stuff gets very confusing after a while. Just the sheer act of controlling the game becomes a little bit burdensome. You never have to be in a hurry because it's not that actiony, but it does make it feel like it takes a long time to do anything. It just, the game's pace really slows down as you're moving through these environments because they're so complex, and there's a lot of like, oh, you didn't do that right. Now you fell down and you have to go and redo this part of the platforming. And so I find it just a little tedious at times. No, that was basically what I wanted to say about it. Any of you guys get a chance to pick it up?
I have actually never played this game.
Oh, perfect opportunity.
The series never really did it for me. I don't know why. It's kind of that weird place where it's like I thought it was funny, but I wasn't like really hyper engaged with the gameplay. But I've never actually played this particular one.
Yeah, I haven't either.
I played one of the DS ones, and it just never quite clicked with me. As I'm not sure if maybe this one would work a little bit better. Because I know each of these games kind of have their strengths and weaknesses.
That's for sure.
I think I actually prefer the first game.
I do too.
Saying that, I've not actually played Bowser's Inside Story. I've played the first and the second, and I much prefer the first one.
How many of these have they made by now? I'm just curious.
There are four now. And I think most people feel that the odd numbers are the best. So the second and the fourth one both have a lot of issues. Although they're not irredeemable, they have a lot of good qualities too. But I think in both cases that I know certainly for the second one, my feeling was that it just became remarkably tedious, the battle system. I believe the last boss of that game took me about 2 hours to beat. And it's a lot of using these, ridiculously complex, item moves that require you to do like long chains of accurate button presses and in order to do any kind of damage and to do the recovery and everything, and the bosses just have way too many hit points, and all it's all just really old because you end up doing the same moves over and over again because they're the only thing that does any, like, your normal attacks do almost no damage in that game.
Was it 2 hours or with lots of restarts, or was it like Radiant Historia bullshit where the last boss goes on forever?
No, it's that. It's the latter. I mean, it's not that difficult. Like, you know, you can heal yourself and stay in the race. It's just such a marathon. And I that really tanked that game's score back when I reviewed it, because I thought, you know, this, it was symptomatic of a problem throughout the whole game, but that was just the epitome of, come on, guys. No one thinks this is fun. Just, this is not well balanced at all, you know? The first one is much better, and I think it's really a pretty great game. So I was thinking last night as I was playing, I've put a couple hours into it, on the Wii U version now. I'm mostly playing on the TV, just so I like to kick back. I don't use remote play a ton, but it looks pretty good, I would say, on the gamepad screen. But I was just thinking, like, these virtual console RPGs, I hardly ever finish them. And I've done a couple, but
I think they just come off as disposable because you don't spend that much money on them.
Well, it's not even just that. These are often games that I've already played through multiple times or in earlier years. So for me, if I play it for a few hours, I kind of ignite that nostalgia and sort of remember what I liked about it. Maybe I'm surprised by something I don't like as much anymore. And usually that's what I'm looking for in the first place. I don't necessarily buy one of these games to spend 30 hours playing through it. And yeah, the low price helps. But also, it's just like, for me, if I get 2 or 3 hours worth of like fond memories and, oh yeah, I remember that thing, that's really funny, that's enough for me. Like, that's a good enough value. It's kind of a weird way to approach your game releases, you know, but because they're old games, in a lot of cases, they're ones that I already know very well. I'm okay with it. I think that I've done that with a lot of virtual console games, actually. I don't necessarily buy them intending to complete them.
I think another reason maybe is because they do stagger the releases so much.
That's the one word for it.
When something comes out, which is quite exciting, that I think you're more keen to pick it up. Because you just realize, oh, the last couple of weeks haven't been anything that great up, but this game I had fond memories of, let's try this again. Whereas if the whole collection was out there, you wouldn't necessarily search it out.
Yeah, it's like the economy of drought. A starving man will eat anything.
A starving man at Western Sizzler.
There's a decent amount of virtual console stuff coming out in April. At least in America, they have turned it into a kind of almost like a special promotion, you know, like a Summer of Arcade or a, you know, PlayStation Spring Fever. They've made it the retro month, or I forget exactly what they're calling
it. Do they actually call it Spring Fever?
I think it's a month of memories is what they're calling it.
Oh, that's awful.
But it's like, you know, 3 or 4 virtual console games every week, including Mario 3 finally coming out way later than they originally promised it. But that's going to be good. And that game's actually coming out on Wii U and 3DS the same day, which is how they should be doing a lot more things, I would say. You know, and all these GBA games coming out, and there's even some on top of that, coming out for one system or the other. So I love it. I wish every month was a month of memories. Like, I don't know why they can't keep up this pace, but I'm glad that for the first time in what seems like a long time, they are kind of putting a little bit of focus on Virtual Console, and they're trying to make, and for them, it's also great publicity for NES Remix 2, which is coming out towards the end of the month, and they can kind of cross promote those two things, which makes total sense, and they should. And it's just nice to see them sort of promoting this amazing archival feature that they've developed over the past couple generations. So Lewis, I know you're playing one of the new Virtual Console games for GBA 2. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I did mention about how Nintendo draws out their releases, as it were, but I think it was they did a really good release for the GBA. They had a number of really cool titles, and I don't think there was a single bad one amongst them, really. But the particular game that I was looking at was Advance Wars, and that's because it's one of my favourite Game Boy Advance games, really, and probably one of my favourite portable games in general. And so, obviously, this is the original Advance Wars. For the people who don't know, released back in 2001 in America and shortly after in 2002 over here. Again, as great as the game is and as critically acclaimed as it is, the sales haven't been great for the series. So I thought it would be worth just having a quick breakdown of what the game is, just in case there's people listening who have heard about the game who have never picked it up. And because it is out on the the Virtual Console now, it's obviously a great opportunity if it's a game which interests you.
It's also a great game.
It's a fantastic game.
It totally is.
And it's actually, although it's just like a ROM dump essentially, it's surprisingly a good version of the game. And it's oddly, I think, one of those games which kind of benefit from being able to play it on both the TV and the gamepad. One of the reasons being, if you're playing a multiplayer game, if you're playing normal rules and you don't have the fog of war turned on, it's good to just play it on the TV. And Dan Koopman actually told me a little tip of this, where you can sync more than one controller at the same time on these games.
No kidding.
Yeah, you really can. So what you can do, for a turn-based game like this, you can have two controllers synced up. You can have the gamepad and a pro controller. And when you switch turns, the other person just takes their turn, as it were. You just have to not, you know, resist temptation of, you know, selecting something on the other person's turn. But you don't have to, you know, go switching the gamepad across the room, which is really cool.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that temptation existed before when you played it with one GBA. Where it's like, oh, sorry, I just totally hosed your turn. It was an accident, honest.
So people may not understand exactly what you're talking about, Lewis, but Advance Wars, because it's a turn-based strategy, one side makes their moves, and then the other side makes their moves. And the original GBA game had a really nice multiplayer mode that you could play with only one system and one copy of the game. You would just set up a two-player game, and you would literally take turns passing back and forth the GBA to take the turns on each side. And you know, I don't know how much that got used. I'm sure some people used it a ton. And I thought it was just really clever. And so I really like that it's not like the emulator on Virtual Console is implementing some kind of like true multiplayer mode, you know, couch co-op or something into a game that otherwise didn't have it. But because they let you sync up multiple controllers, which is probably otherwise a very useless feature, right? But for this game, it's perfect because then you can do the swap multiplayer back and forth locally without actually having to swap anything physical. You just kind of each, you know, one person plays, the other person plays, but you could even each have your own display, because if you're playing on the gamepad, you wouldn't even have to be in the same room necessarily as the other person playing, because you have your own screen. So that's pretty great. That's a great use of the console, really.
Yeah, it really is. And
if you're playing with Fog of War mode, you can just pass the controller around still.
Yeah, you could totally do that. You pass the gamepad.
Because if it's not on the TV, they can't see what you don't want them to see anyway.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, you could turn the TV off or put on something different.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it actually looks really good on the gamepad, and it just feels like I'm pretty sure you've mentioned it on the show yourselves, but like a Game Boy, you know, triple XL. But the quality of the screen looks really cool, so passing that back and forth also feels comfortable. And so yeah, it works. It works great on the normal mode and on Fog of War. So it's pretty cool that they've managed to get this. I mean, it not even necessarily deliberately, but it all just happens to work on this Virtual Console release. I think it's the better term.
Quite lucky.
Yeah, very lucky of them.
It's not necessarily luck. I think it's just they're selecting a game that works extremely well for the format that they're implementing here. And, you know, I think I certainly agree with everyone who wishes that these games were also available on 3DS, and maybe one day they will be. But I think if you're going to release these on Wii U, you should spend some time thinking about which games are most appropriate for that format and you know, for the controller capabilities that are offered with Wii U. And I think they've done a nice job of it so far. I mean, WarioWare is coming out, today, I think it's.
Yeah.
Out. And that game has a single unit multiplayer mode where on the original, you had to, you know, have two people holding the same GBA and they're both using the shoulder buttons or something on the side, which, especially on an SP, is very difficult to do. And you're also looking at a tiny little screen, but on the Wii U gamepad, that thing's big, it's wide, it has a big screen that both people can easily see. That's going to be a fantastic way to play that game.
Also, it kind of defeats the spirit of the game, but you could also sync a second controller to use for that.
Oh, yeah.
And you have your own controller and your own button.
You could, but I think it would be more fun to share the screen, because that's really what it was designed
for. Exactly, yeah.
You know, it's part of the wackiness of WarioWare to both be holding onto the same piece of hardware. But the fact that it's so big is actually a huge benefit in that case. So I think they've been very smart about it, and I think the emulation's really good from what I've seen. And I'm looking forward to more. All right, so let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to hear about Lewis's new game, Twisted Fusion. And we'll talk about Smash Brothers, read some other listener mail, have a lot more fun. Stick around.
April 10th, 2014, 1530 UTC. Nintendo News! Nintendo downloads highlight new digital content for Nintendo systems. Redmond, Washington via the Business Wire. This week, Nintendo downloads includes the following featured content. On the Virtual Console on Wii U, Kirby and the Amazing Mirror. April is a month to remember with classic games launching each week. Summon Red, Yellow, and Green Kirby to help you solve puzzles, fight enemies, or take out big baddies. Use your copy abilities such as the arrow-shooting Cupid Kirby or the Melee Master Smash Kirby while platforming through maze-like worlds. Need a break from the action? Try minigames such as Crackety Hack from Kirby's Wave Ride, which also star our favorite pink hero and friends. We just said he was red, yellow, and green. I guess those assholes get left out of this. WarioWare Inc. Micro Mega Game $. April is a month to remember. We covered that. With classic games launching each week! It exclaims that, just to be clear. Prepare for lightning quick gameplay as you blaze through more than 200 bizarre micro games designed by a crazy crew of Wario's cronies. Simple controls make each game in WarioWare, Inc. : Mega Micro Game $ easy to get into. Until the games start coming faster.
And faster. And faster!
Think you can outwit Wario? Question mark. You actually can't outwit Wario, because he's a game. He's programmed, and he doesn't actually exist. Just to clarify, this press release is somewhat confusing. Nintendo eShop on the Nintendo 3DS. LEGO, trademark, The Hobbit, TM. LEGO The Hobbit allows gamers to play along with their favorite scenes from the first two films in the Hobbit trilogy. Great. Great. Awesome. LEGO Hobbit. Perfect. Conception 2, Children of the Seven Stars. In this JRPG, monsters have invaded the world of Altara, and only a few special individuals imbued with the power of the Star God are equipped to fight them. Conception 2, Children of the Seven Stars, will be available on April 15th. Point of order to make in that particular announcement is that the game is called Conception, i.e. to conceive children. Nintendo, not quite willing to put that part in the press release. I think I can understand that reservation. Nintendo eShop sales. DuckTales Remastered. Embark on the authentic Disney adventure around the world to retrieve 5 legendary treasures with Scrooge McDuck and his nephews, Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Now through 9 a.m. PT on April 17th, get DuckTales Remastered for 50% off in the Nintendo eShop on Wii U. Escape from Zombie City. For a limited time, Escape from Zombie City will be 50% off in the Nintendo eShop on Nintendo 3DS. This promotion starts at 9 a.m. PT on April 12th and ends 9 a.m. PT April 27th. G-Style Co. Select G-Style games will be on sale on Nintendo eShop 3DS, including Crazy Construction, Chain Blaster, Undead Bowling, and Jump Trials Supreme. This offer starts at 9 a.m. PT on April 12th and ends at 9 a.m. PT April 27th. Also new this week, Mach Rider TM, Virtual Console, Nintendo 3DS, Atlantic Quest, Nintendo eShop on 3DS, available April 15th. Governor of Poker! Governor of Poker! Nintendo eShop on Nintendo 3DS. Boxel! Nintendo eShop, Nintendo 3DS, and My Exotic Farm. Oh, fuck this. No! No! Nintendo eShop on Wii U. God damn it! Permanent price reduction. My Farm, fuck! Nintendo eShop on Wii U. Starting today, the price of My Farm is being reduced from $7.99 to $4.99. God damn it. Coming soon, popular NES game Super Mario Bros. 3 launches for both Wii U and Nintendo 3DS on April 17th. Which is why we got this press release on April 10th. Considered by many to be one of the best games ever made, this title makes a great way to enjoy the Easter holiday weekend and beyond. What?
Welcome back, everyone. It's the second part of the show. We've got a few things we want to talk about here, but I want to start off with something we didn't have time for in the first segment, which is Twisted Fusion. So, Lewis, I know you've stayed up very late to do the show with us, and I'm sure part of the reason is because you want to plug your game, and you should. But I'm not going to make it easy on you. I have some questions, and I have to start off with, why would you make a Wii U exclusive game? Serious question. Like, what is your thought process?
It's a generally good question. The thought process being is simply, I've been doing mobile phone games now for about the last 8 years or so. And I feel I'm at the point now where I want to move up to a console. And not thinking the business sense, Nintendo seems to make sense in terms of it's the main console I would play. But in terms of actually something to make money out of, that's kind of why I've got a Kickstarter here. Because the Kickstarter will fund the kit I need. So it's a very safe proposition to, I mean, even if the game tanks, I've covered myself because I funded what I needed with the Kickstarter. In fact, it's more of a safer proposition for me than any of my other ventures.
Is this your day job, making games?
No, it's not. No, I have a normal IT day job.
So so you work a day job and you make games at night and you work on this Nintendo side and host their podcast.
And edit said podcast.
Gee, dude, you're crazy. This is great. So as a hobby, has this been... You know, you said, you know, years of making phone games. Has it been something that has been financially successful for you? You don't have to get into details, but I'm just curious. Like, is it self-sustaining? Is it something that – is it essentially an expensive hobby? Or is it something that you actually kind of make a little bit of money on?
It's more of a hobby, really. It pulls in a little bit of money, but – it probably just breaks even to the amount when I need to buy the new iPod Touch or the new other device to make sure things are compatible. It's really not pulling in lots of money, but it is getting quite a lot of downloads in terms of the free versions of the games and so on. So it's reaching quite a nice audience.
Do you feel that reaching that audience, whether they pay you for the game or not, or whether it amounts to, you know, something that's economically viable, do you feel that reaching out to that audience is part of the satisfaction that keeps you doing this?
It completely is. It always has been a hobby to me. I mean, if it was to make some money, then that's just icing on the cake, really. But, I mean, the reason why I do make the games is because it's a fun thing to do. I mean, it's I sometimes find it more fun than playing them, which is odd in itself. But yeah, I mean, it's also the reason why I'm jumping onto the Wii U and my choice for that as a console. It's completely a personal choice in terms of if I simply was asked, you know, which of your consoles would you like your game on? Wii U would be my choice just because I've always been a big fan of Nintendo. And I'm generally just going to get a kick to, you know, just see it on there, see it on the eShop. And just developing it, it's just a real blast just kind of seeing it on Nintendo's quirky hardware, on the gamepad, on the TV. It's just a bit weird, and it is completely a hobby, which is a very weird approach for a professional, because I assume as soon as you go into the eShop and selling your game, you're a professional developer, whether you're indie or not. But it is a hobby. It's a weird situation to be in, but that is the honest situation.
I love that answer, and I really appreciate your honesty there, because I think it says a lot for your character, and it says a lot for the kind of effort you would put into this game. I mean, you're making this game because you want to make this game. Like, you know, not that there's anything wrong with wanting to get rich off of it, but you're probably realistic that that's not going to happen. But there's a lot to be... I mean, I don't make games, but I would be thrilled to see a photo of me or a quote from one of my reviews used on the eShop front page or something like that. And that might happen one day. Probably, I don't really write much anymore, so probably not. But I would be thrilled. Like, I would take photos of that and send it to my parents and be like, look, they put me on the store. I mean, Neil probably does this all the time because he gets quoted often. And Scott does too. And I think that's great. I think that's a great reason to do it. I think it's a great reason to make it a Wii U exclusive, and it makes me more interested in what you're doing. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the game itself? I mean, you mentioned it, you gave the like real top level before, but you talked about this being sort of open world. I mean, in a 2D platformer, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd mix, and a lot of people kind of question me when I use that term. And it's a bit hard to describe, really. It's kind of like... It's not Metroidvania, or at least I don't believe it is, although it does share a few things in common. It may have more in common with, say, Shantae. But you essentially are kind of dropped in a big world, and there are no transitions from going to, like, the start of the game to the end of the game. And it's not built into chapters or anything like that. And you don't... I guess there are a few little bits you need to backtrack. But it's not really a major part of the gameplay itself. But you can go back and find secrets which will help you out. But it's not, you know, mandatory. I'm just trying to create something which is unique, really. I'm not trying to... Because I know there's a lot of projects out there which say, oh, you know, there's a lack of 2D Metroid, so we're going to create one of them. I just wanted to create something which... I don't know, really. It just felt different. But how I would pitch the game... It is kind of a mashup of almost Metroid, Zelda, and I guess Shantae, and maybe a bit of Mutant Muds in there. It might even have more in common with something like Cave Story. So it is a real mashup of kind of just different 2D gameplay types. There's a lot of kind of action in the 2D platforming, but there's also moments where it's just kind of a bit more peaceful as you're traveling from one area to the next, and you get to see some of these kind of more ongoing systems, like the day-to-night system. There's weather systems in there as well, and these affect, obviously, naturally how the game looks, if it's day or night, or if it's raining or so on, but... You'll get different enemies pop out depending on those conditions, or they'll react differently.
So that's something Shantae does.
Yeah. And I guess ironically, it's something which kind of like Advance Wars does as well, in terms of different weathers and affect you in different ways. But yeah, I mean, the game has a big focus on water, and the enemies are all kind of weak to it as such. So when it's the rare time it is raining in that universe... all the enemies kind of go a bit crazy, and if they can see you at all, they'll just charge at you straight away, because they're getting drained of their energy. They'll just kind of go all out on you. So it does add, I think, a nice layer to the same place can feel quite different. And a lot of it is to do with randomness, and I know some people won't think that's a great move, but I do like how it feels, and it does just... It doesn't feel scripted at all.
Is it a game that you're meant to play multiple times? Is it fairly short so that you can kind of go through multiple cycles and see how it changes each time? Is that what you're going for?
It's actually quite a fairly long game, but you could definitely replay it, but it's also the sort of game I feel that you wouldn't necessarily have to start from the beginning. You could just keep exploring and see the things you didn't, or go to the areas which you could do more with now because you have some certain ability. It wouldn't necessarily help you complete the game, but there's going to be some extra content there.
So the main content of the game in terms of the places you can go, the sort of events and the level designs, is all of that handcrafted? That stuff that you're making, and that will be the same experience for every person who plays it?
Oh, yeah. In terms of level structure, yeah, it's not procedurally generated or anything like that. Okay. You might go through a certain stage, and what enemies might be there might be completely different. I mean, it might be sparse and nothing's there. It might be, quite a few B enemies there instead.
That's cool. So it is very much a designed game, and yet there's a lot of things within it that are randomized.
That's right, yeah. Where it gets more consistent, there are these set of towers, which are kind of the main levels, in quotes, in the game. And in them, obviously, the weather system doesn't really play any effect, nor does the day or night system. And so there you have some more traditional, stage-based platforming where you need to get to the top and you complete various puzzles or defeat very specific enemies in certain orders to get your way to the top of these towers. And you can tackle those in any order.
Okay, so these are like the dungeons, and the other part that you were talking about first is really the kind of the overworld that connects these?
That's right, yeah.
Oh, that sounds really cool, man. Yeah, I like that. It sounds almost like Ease, actually, a series that we've talked about a couple times on this podcast. That's a game, Zelda 2, although this sounds a little more like maybe Ease 3 or Ease 3 might actually be a good example of it. It didn't have all the random stuff, but it had the overworld and then the distinct levels and dungeons that you would go into.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, something which isn't really on the Kickstarter page itself, and it's purely because I don't have the graphic assets ready for it, but I've mentioned it on a few sites and so on, is how the gamepad actually interacts with the game. What I've got running at the moment, because there's the weather and the time system involved, I've basically made the gamepad's Cora's kind of smartphone. And because she does kind of come from the normal world beforehand, it does make sense. And so on this kind of smartphone screen of hers, she's got basically a set of widgets, and you've got a thing like some standard things, like you've got like a clock so you can see the actual time and how that's ticking by. You've got the weather widget, and you can go in there and you get like a forecast of what is happening next, so it's not random. but in addition to that, and this is not something I've talked about really, at the end of the second video I've uploaded, you will see Cora freeing this little creature from the insides of a bigger slime creature. And what happens, you see this little creature's dancing at the end and the video ends. But those little creatures kind of end up in this little farm, and it has this little kind of Digimon-esque element to it. It's not a huge part of the game, but you can manage that on the gamepad at all times, and it's like having a little Tamagotchi in your corner. If it's not really for you, you can kind of ignore it, but if that's the sort of thing you're into, you can just kind of multi-manage that on the gamepad screen while you're platforming or doing anything you are on the main screen.
Very cool, man. So is this a game that you're making entirely by yourself? Do you have any help from other people?
Well, I'm the programmer, as it were. Someone else is doing the actual sprite, the 2D sprite art itself. Someone's doing I'm commissioning to do the anime profile art. And someone else is doing the music. So it's all kind of commission-based. So it's an odd system where I'm kind of designing and programming the game, and I'm getting all the assets kind of commissioned outright. I've got a lot of this stuff beforehand, and it's part of the reason why I've managed to keep the cost of the final goal itself, in my opinion, so low. And that's because it doesn't cover anyone's salary. It doesn't really cover assets for the game. It basically, without saying too much, it covers the kit and some necessary fees to launch it in America and Europe. And that's it. So it really is like a kind of a hobby and like a love project, as it were.
That's great, man. Well, I wish you luck. I'm definitely going to be taking a closer look at it. And when does the Kickstarter end?
We're just about a week and a bit into it. And okay. So the Kickstarter ends at the end of the month on the 30th.
Oh, great. Okay. And that's easy.
It's actually doing. Yeah. So yeah, at the end of the month it ends. It's doing pretty well, but it's entered kind of that middle point of Kickstarters, or it's the
where they slow down.
Starting into where, well, yeah, it's just kind of hit a brick wall currently. Yeah. But before it hit that brick wall, it managed to get to 60%, which is very promising.
Mm-hmm.
Especially kind of the first week stage.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the larger scale Kickstarters, like the one Renegade Kid is doing now, or even Double Fine, sort of the prototype of doing this on a large scale, it seems like they do a really good job of having like updates every single day, so that hopefully they'll hit on something that people want to talk about, or they try to find ways to convince people who've already pledged to increase the amount that they've pledged by sort of revealing new information. A lot of this stuff is very much planned out in advance. I would imagine it's very hard to manage the Kickstarter to that level of detail when it's really, you're doing this in your spare time. It's got to be really tough.
Yeah, it is pretty tough, actually. And I've been trying to keep on top of things, and I've been doing, I think, updates every other day on the Kickstarter page itself. But I've tried to get out something unique to someone, like some site or something, each day. And that's been working so far. It does take a surprisingly amount of time just to manage a Kickstarter page.
Mm-hmm.
And to just get people to, you know, get eyeballs on it and to actually read it or to see your video.
Right. And then that's the best you can do, right? I mean, at that point, the project has to sort of speak for itself, and it'll either convince them or not. And people might have a variety of reasons for choosing to back a Kickstarter or not back it and move on to something else. But, I think if you can get them to check it out, watch your video, then you've done a great job, because at that point, they're informed and they can make their own decision.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think it's important to... the Kickstarter video doesn't have me talking to the camera, giving the viewer reasons and why they should give me their money. Maybe that would have worked better, but I thought just a simple, the entire video is just going to be gameplay with a little warning at the beginning, say it's in development,
and it's a little
splash screen at and a little splash screen at the end saying if you like, you know, please pledge to make this real. One thing I would like to touch on, if that was all right, are basically some of the different rewards.
Oh, yeah.
But basically, I did add a kind of an extra small one after someone's suggestion, but everything above that initial one does come with a copy of the eShop download itself. But obviously that's not terribly exciting. Obviously, if you want the game, you're kind of expecting that. In addition to that, I think it's been pretty... it's fairly fair priced, I think, on the pledges. I mean, I know a lot of Kickstarters have things like, you know, get yourself in the game tiers and design this, design that, but therefore these, you know, ridiculous sums of money. And just because of what sort of project this is, I've been able to put those sort of really cool things for a lot less cash. And so I've got like a design an NPC tier, and it's, in my opinion, it's not that highly priced at all. And you not only get to like send a photo of yourself, or if you've got your own original character, you send a picture of that in, and you also get to say a bit about their personality. And it's not just a single line of text they'll reel off when you bump into them. We'll work with that pledger and make a little script for them, and they'll appear in different parts of the game, and kind of their little story will go on as the game does. And so there's lots of little things like that. I mean, there, some of the slightly higher ones, you get to even like design an enemy or design one of the playable characters itself, which you'll be able to play on order modes just from the get-go. And even that one, compared to a lot of the other Kickstarters I've seen, I think that's fairly reasonable price for like a design a playable character you can just play the whole game mm-hmm. with.
Right, so which is probably a lot of work for you to implement.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I mean, so, but it's really cool though, because I think there is, it's nice that there are games where those things are accessible, because I know what you're talking about. I've seen in other Kickstarters where they'll have some fairly invasive interaction that the backers can get with the game development, you know, where it's like design a character or something. But those are like $10,000 or $50,000, you know. It's like, come out to our VIP party. Well, you have to buy a plane ticket, and, you know, you're going out there and you're spending enormous sums of money. And of course, you're doing it for the game. I mean, you're not expecting to get a, it's, this is like PBS. I'm not sure that you're familiar with that, Lewis, but, you know, they do pledge drives and they give away little bags and CDs and stuff like that. And it, you're not expecting to get something that's actually worth what you pledge. That would sort of defeat the purpose, right? But they're, yeah, they're more gifts for people to thank them for backing the game. But yeah, I mean, on a lot of games, those are really out of reach. You know, the really interesting ones, the ones that might make you feel like you're really contributing to the game. You know, when you, I think it would be actually be really, really cool to download a game from the eShop, play it on your Wii U on the gamepad, and see something in there that you created. I mean, obviously, that is enough to motivate you to make the game in the first place, but that has to, you know, a smaller version of that experience has to be motivating to other people as well.
Well, yeah, certainly. I think if, because I've backed quite a few projects now, and yeah, a lot of them I would really like to go to those tiers, but they're just a bit silly in terms of pricing. But yeah, it's really that you kind of want to help, not just really fund it, but kind of support it in some, you know, in some more tangible way.
Yeah.
So it's cool that you can like see a little piece of you almost in the game itself afterwards.
Yeah, that's great, man. Well, best of luck. I hope people will go check it out. You know, that's really all we're asking, is to go look at it. I've looked at it. I think it looks pretty cool. I'm going to go read up some more about it. It's actually one of several gaming Kickstarters that launched at the beginning of April that I've got them paged up in Safari on my phone, and I just got to find a weekend where I've got time to go through and do my research and figure out which ones I'm going to get behind. But this one sounds really cool, and, you know, it is fairly common to hear about Kickstarters that have a Wii U version, either as, you know, part of the main thing or maybe a stretch goal. But a Wii U exclusive is highly unusual, yeah, on Kickstarter. And I think you deserve some credit for kind of going out there and doing something that, you know, by its very nature, limits your audience and limits the number of people who are going to be willing to back you, especially because a lot of people on Kickstarter seem to want PC versions of things. So, you know, ruling that out from the get-go and saying, this really isn't exclusive, I just want to make this a Wii U game, it's a gutsy move, but it's got to be appealing to some people as well to think, wait, this is the game. I mean, this is only a Wii U game. I have a Wii U. I want to play cool stuff on it. It sounds like you've put some nice thought into what you would do with that system and how you're going to make it really special for the Wii U. And, you know, I think it sounds great, man.
Oh, fantastic.
So that's Twisted Fusion. We'll have a link, of course, in the show notes, so you can go check it out on Kickstarter. But give it your consideration, please. Now we're going to move into listener mail, and Lewis is going to stick around, I hope, for that part.
Of course.
We've got a few interesting topics, and we'll get through as many as time allows for. But I think John needs to read the first email here, and I think it's going to kick us off into a topic that I know people want us to talk about, at least a little bit.
Okay, Kasaki Project writes, for glory mode, deal with it, haters.
Okay, yeah. So that's the reference the Smash Brothers Direct that we had earlier this week, which was an avalanche of information about the new Smash Brothers games on 3DS coming first in the summer, and Wii U coming in winter 2014, which, as Chris Kohler pointed out, is a span of about 10 days. At the end of this calendar year. I don't know. It depends on how literally you want to interpret that, but it's potentially ominous. It sounds like a quasi-delay to next year, if you ask me. But there's certainly... I mean, Melee came out December 10th,
yeah,
I think, in 2001. So there is a precedent for Smash Bros.
But remember, that was also not that far off the release of the system.
Right. It was kind of a second wave launch title, along with Pikmin. Right. But yeah, they could definitely release it in December. Nintendo does that all the time. They release Mario Kart 7 in December. So it's viable. I hope that's what happens. I don't want to have to wait till next year. I found myself pretty excited once I actually watched the video for myself. I really got into it. I think it was presented incredibly well. And I don't know that they announced any one thing that makes me super hyped about it or super concerned, really, either way. But just seeing it in action for that length of time, it really did kind of, I think, crystallize my hype for the game in a way that hasn't happened yet before this. I'm curious to hear your guys' reactions. Was there anything in particular that really stood out to you that you wanted to talk about, or that has kind of affected your feelings about the game as it's now coming up fairly soon?
Well, the one thing I thought was interesting was there was the one kind of offhand comment they make about the online and Brawl, and they said, back then there were just certain things we couldn't do,
like be online.
Yeah, like, and it almost seemed like they were talking about Brawl like it was made in like 1998 and not 2008.
It wasn't.
And the thing is, they just kind of like. And they just moved on to the right they just moved right on past that and said, oh yeah, there were certain things in Brawl that we just couldn't do back then, but now it's going to be amazing. Well, but they didn't really go into actually much detail about stuff. They were just online.
It felt like code.
It was it really was. Yeah. It 2008, because it was running on GameSpy. It was 1998. It was just 1998 in 2008. I mean, I think they probably feel somewhat liberated by being able to control their own destiny on the online front. And
Sakurai has relished this in the past. I mean, for all of my severe issues with Kid Icarus Uprising, that game has excellent online support, and it doesn't even have the benefit of a Wii LAN adapter to plug into. So, for a lot of reasons, I have reason to be hopeful about the online, but I'm so burned by Brawl that I don't think I'll really believe it until I can try it for myself.
I'm not even sure I'll believe it then.
I doubt they're going to do a demo or a beta test or anything remotely of the sort. So unfortunately, I'm afraid that the anxiety over whether they can actually pull off the online this time is going to be fighting it right up until the day it comes out.
I mean, we've documented extensively the litany of issues we experienced with the online mode of the Wii game. So... Yeah. I think the best thing they could have done would be to not even mention that Brawl had online, because it was cataclysmic. So
bad.
I think.
Yeah.
To me, the more shit they can eat over that, the better. I mean, the more that they're upfront about it and basically tell us in no uncertain terms, hey, we know that wasn't good enough. This one is different. That would be a little more clear about that. That would actually make me feel a lot better. My concern is that they don't know how bad it was.
I would almost rather they have come out too.
Just admit it.
This
sucked.
This Smash Bros is going to have online, like they've never done it before. Just straight up, just disavow it that online even existed in that game. Like, just this is the first Smash Bros that's online, and you'd be like, wait, no, it's not. Yes, it is. And then they just walk off, and they just kill the Nintendo Direct. Because it is effectively, for me, going to be the first Smash Bros. That has online. I attempted many times to play Brawl online, and never really succeeded. So, I would almost rather they just be so embarrassed they don't even want to think about it. Because I'm sure they are. I'm sure that when they went back and played Brawl online at some point, somebody somewhere goes, you know, this really isn't acceptable.
Well, a bit. Sakurai was more embarrassed.
But that's his personality.
Because exactly, I think that's kind of where the not quite apology, but the mention of how the experience wasn't as people wanted for the Wii game. But yeah, because of the work on Kid Icarus's online mode, I've got a lot more faith that this one is going to do right.
You can't execute controls, but that's a different issue.
That is a completely different issue.
But I am still kind of curious about the 3DS version of this
poorly,
and how it's going to control. But I think it'll be a little more familiar than Kid Icarus.
It will be more competent than Kid Icarus, certainly. I'm sorry. I don't care how much hate we get. Yeah. That game had bad controls. It just did.
I think it's a huge issue.
But it is it is
game.
It is
I'm
effectively 2D.
I'm not really
though.
Worried
it is
about
effectively
Smash Bros.
2D though. Right.
Yeah, this seems like a better fit control-wise for the platform. And, of course, the 3DS version is coming out first. It has a special multiplayer thing called, what was it?
Smash Run,
yeah. I kept trying to fit Brawl in there.
Brawl Run.
But I think that looks neat. It's an interesting way for them to handle it, and I bet that is in place of any kind of single-player mode. And I bet that the, you know, so that mode is exclusive to the 3DS version. I bet the Wii version will have an exclusive mode that will be something akin to Subspace Emissary, but, you know, hopefully done in a different way that's more fun. But I think it will essentially have some kind of single player slash co-op adventure mode that you'll go through that won't be in the 3DS version. That's my guess. But, you know, we didn't really learn that much more about online in terms of stability or optimization. We did learn more about the features and the way they're going to handle it. And, they, you know, they talked about having friend matches, which I think are going to be very viable, thanks to Miiverse. They talked about the for fun and for glory modes, which you play with strangers. As much as I hate the naming, I think mostly just the negative space of them naming for glory for the tournament style online mode, I'm okay with them calling it that, but then when they call the other one for fun, I'm like, you know, I like glory too when I play the crazy pure Smash Brothers mode. And at the same time, I think people who play the Final Destination No Items thing would say, hey, we play for fun too. I mean, that's not really fair
to...
Yeah,
I think it works both ways.
Yeah, it does. And actually, like, as much catering as it seems like they were doing to the tournament crowd, you know, they built a Final Destination-style version of many of the levels in the game so that you can play all of those in the For Glory mode, which is smart. You know, it helps break up the monotony of, you know, Final Destination, not a very interesting level as Smash Brothers goes.
It's a stupid level.
So.
It's awful.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're...
It's a purple platform on purple space.
Right, so they're spicing it up, and they're letting you do it with all the cool, you know, Mario and Yoshi backgrounds. But they I think, annoyed tournament gamers as much as anything because of some of the decisions they made. I was reading Justin Berube's editorial about it, and he plays tournament style, or at least sometimes. I mean, he appreciates that version of the game, and he likes to play that at least part of the time. And he seemed to have some issues with the way they're implementing it because they only show time battles. Now, maybe that's something you can set in the options. But, you know, he's like, that's not really how most people play in tournaments. They prefer stock. And there were some other kind of odd things about it. Also, the fact that I think it's really weird that in the for fun mode, you can't even play that mode on Final Destination, which I think is really strange because... When you turn on all the items and all the Pokemon,
well, I think it's an admission by him that these aren't fun levels.
I mean, I think it's the least fun level for me, but it seems like you should be able to turn it on or off. You know, like that's just kind of weird.
I fully expect he will do something to troll because he does, and that may be his way of doing it. It's like, oh, you can't play these in for fun because they're not.
Yeah, during the direct itself, I couldn't tell when he was trolling and when he wasn't at times.
No, there isn't a when he is and when he isn't. He is.
He's in a state of mind.
That's what he does. I mean, that's why we had the Nintendo Direct a couple Nintendo Directs ago where we thought it was a Mario Kart announcement. No, it's Brawl. Or it's Smash Brothers. Because that's what he does. His brain is constantly in troll mode. There is no non... I mean, the whole Japan time thing from Brawl was a constant string of trolling. He would give you something exciting just often enough that you stayed up to check to find out he wrote a soliloquy about bumpers.
Yeah.
That's what he does. So
it shouldn't be a surprise that the guy who makes Smash Brothers has a good sense of humor. I mean, it's one of the funniest games ever, and it's
that he likes
so
to amuse
wacky.
Himself above all else.
Right.
So I think a good question about this is... Will the For Glory mode appease the 20 players? Will it satisfy them?
No, nothing satisfies them.
I don't think so, no. It might be a good way to practice. Like, if you're interested in getting into that scene, it might be a good way to kind of learn some of the strategies and the techniques. But to me, it sounds like kind of a farm league, because if you're really into tournament play, number one, you probably don't want to play random people. You probably want to play people who you know are good. And number two, you're probably not going to be interested in putting up with the online lag, even if it's very good, or all the weird stuff about playing that mode, you know? So I kind of think that a lot of people who are really into tournament mode would rather play locally, and are probably used to, they probably already have people to play locally because that's how they got so good in the first place. That's how they train for tournaments anyway, with Melee or even Brawl. is by playing locally. And so I think they might appreciate it as like something that you might use on a rainy day or something, but probably not as like a, as their main use of the game anymore. I think it'll be more something that people who want to dabble in tournament play or just who kind of are curious and want to see like, could I actually hang? You know, I think it's neat that those people have a way to do it. It's weird to me that it's positioned as an equal to the other one. You know, to me, that's kind of a weird way to present it, or at least it was in the, that's how it was presented in the direct, is that these are equal modes, you know, and I feel like even if you think those are equally viable ways to play the game, I don't think you're nearly going to have equal numbers of people playing online in those two modes. I think most people want to play for fun. And so it's just kind of weird to me that they've set it out and given it such prevalence in within the framework of the game.
To step back from trolling, I'm going to make an undeniable statement. You are playing less of a game, period, because there is less stuff in the game.
You're turning off most of the content in the game, yes.
Yeah, I mean, these aren't equal modes. There's one mode that has a shit ton of content and one mode that doesn't.
It's very simple and very stripped down, yes.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, though. I think it's smart in the sense that, you know, you can't just sit there and ignore the very vocal tournament community for this game. I mean, you have to throw them a bone, and that's exactly what.
Yeah, and by the way, I applaud
which
that.
I think is very
I'm
smart.
Totally fine with it, by the way. I know Kisaki Project is calling us haters, but I think it's fine that they're doing that. I think the way it's presented is a
little
odd.
But I think
odd.
It should come up on the screen. You suck every time you play that mode. I think it just say, you hate fun and children and puppies, and you should stay in a closet and never come out.
Well, it's already saying the fun part, so...
It's true. It does, actually. It says, oh, you hate fun. Here's a bunch of stages that don't do anything.
Yeah. Would you like to have fun with this game or not?
It's
the question it asks.
Do you hate enjoyment?
It's kind of a double-edged sword, the way that they're presenting it, I have to say. But,
I earnestly believe there is... I mean, having spent enough time reading what this crazy individual writes on his blog, he picked the words here... He picked glory to inflate the egos of the people who play it that way, and then he picked fun to make fun of them. There is no doubt in my mind he picked those two words explicitly because it's funny to him.
I would love for that to be true. I would love to think that he put that much thought into it.
This is the guy who wrote one of the longest posts on the original Smash Dojo was about bumpers.
Yeah. So they also mentioned that there's going to be a few new characters that were announced. I'm sure they're not finished announcing new characters, but a couple of Pokemon. They had Greninja and Charizard as a single character, which makes me wonder if they might also follow up with Squirtle and Bulbasaur. I thought Squirtle was the best of those three in Brawl.
I definitely thought Charizard was the worst, personally.
So maybe they're kind of taking it as a challenge to like.
I didn't like how he controlled. I kind of liked the trainer in the same way I liked the characters that transform, and I liked the ice climbers. I liked the Pikmin.
Yeah, he didn't really do anything.
They felt real weird. They're a very different style of character. So I'm kind of not on board with the standalone Pokemon.
I'm cool with it in the sense that it lets them flesh out those playable characters more by giving them additional moves and focusing on them a little bit more, especially with like Sheik and Zero Suit Samus. But they're making those characters more their own thing. And at the same time, the original characters benefit. I mean, they lose something in the ability to do that transformation. But I think especially like in the case of Zelda and Sheik, most players don't really transform in the middle of a match because it takes so long to do. And it's strategically, it's difficult to adjust to flip that switch in your head and start playing a completely different way. So it's a neat trick. But, you know...
But, again, it goes back to... This isn't a serious fighting game.
I know that. No, but it lets you do more with both characters. Because even, you know, now that Sheik is her own character, she gets an extra move because she doesn't have to transform anymore. But so does Zelda. So it makes Zelda potentially a more fun and interesting character
also. But the point is, individually, they'll never be as interesting as that weird double character thing.
Maybe not, but they've done that through two games already.
Yeah, well, but that's just that. I'm saying it's not just them. I mean, they stripped the Pokemon down to a single character. I think that was the same kind of like, whoa, that's real weird.
Well, also it was weird to have the Pokemon trainer when you also have Mewtwo and Pikachu and all these, you know, Lucario. Like, it's more consistent this way in that you can play as Pokemon. You don't have to throw them out in balls from the background anymore.
I, but again, I think it detracts from the silliness of the game.
Well, maybe they make that up in different ways. I mean, they do have the Wii Fit Trainer, which I talked to a friend the other day, and he's still, like, annoyed by the Wii Fit Trainer. And I'm like, at this point, surely people get that it's really funny and that that character
again,
might be...
Again, that goes back to what probably Sakurai are thinking, you know, it'd be really funny, Wii Fit Trainer. Either he thought of that or somebody in his cadre that's real close to him thought of that, and he just started laughing.
It's funny because it's such a non-character.
I think a possible solution there is that they had a list of every single suggested character, and so they eliminated all of those. And so then they were off to try and find Nintendo characters no one has suggested.
Oh, Animal Crossing. Yeah, they weren't suggested. Yep. Perfect.
Someone's like, oh, that's really obnoxious.
I think if they had done Wii Fit Trainer before Mega Man, no one would care. Because, you know, people don't like Wii Fit Trainer because they're like, that's a slot they could give. First off, I'm like, you don't know how many slots are in this game. They might put 75 characters in here, okay? So the idea that Wii Fit Trainer is taking the place of something more worthwhile, I don't buy that argument at all. But they are doing the things you want. I mean, they're putting in the crazy awesome characters that people actually want. Now, maybe they're never going to get everything that everybody wants. But Mega Man was a huge one for me. Everybody wanted Mega Man in this game, and they did it. I think they just announced him in the wrong order.
Well, no, I think they announced him in the perfect order. Honestly, I really do. If you think Wii Fit Trainer is taking up a slot by being, quote, a joke character, let me be clear with you. It still would have been a joke character. It would have just been a different one.
Hey, Mr. Game & Watch is a joke character.
Rob.
Pichu is a joke character. Rob is a joke character. Yeah, absolutely.
Rob is the ultimate joke character. I mean, they even make fun of Rob being in the game during the... We just said the name, the single-player mode in Brawl.
Subspace Emissary.
Yeah, there's like seven different levels where you fight Rob in various configurations, including like Giant Rob.
Well, I mean,
like,
Rob is literally not a video game character, and yet he's in this...
It's a piece of plastic.
Yeah,
that makes really awful whirring sounds. I mean,
it's like if they made the Zapper a playable character, which they might do.
Well, the Zapper is an item in the game that you can pick up. I mean,
what if you could play as a DS?
Thanks, Peter Molyneux. What if your DS played you?
It would have been a
silly character that they thought was funny regardless of what they did. I think going with the Wii Fit Trainer was brilliant because it's just human enough that you could interact with it, but that completely featureless face is really deeply unsettling. And in every video they've had it, they've really played up how unsettling it is.
And the way that character moves is very unnatural, which to me makes her a great analog to Mr. Game & Watch, who ostensibly was kind of difficult to predict because he doesn't really animate. He just sort of, you know, freeze frames.
He has keyframes. He snaps.
Yeah, so
it's hard
to watch him and predict what he's going to do. And I think the Wii Fit Trainer does that in a different way, but it achieves a similar effect, you know?
For me, the most I laughed at the Wii Fit Trainer introductory video, and I laughed that whole... I mean, I basically went from various degrees of laughing as that video played, was when she was talking in the fight... But she doesn't have a face, so it was just this weird disembodied voice as she kicked the crap out of things, and I'm just losing my mind at how funny this was.
It was beautifully
narrated. They so know what they're doing.
Yes.
I don't know that with a bottle of Jack Daniels I'd come up with a funnier response than Wii Fit Trainer. I don't think I could. I mean, short of the cart from Mario Kart, I mean, there's not really anywhere else to go. You play as a balance board level where if they're not... They're, I mean, they did that. The WarioWare level from the previous game where you had to play WarioWare while the fight was going on or you got killed.
Oh, there will totally be a balance board level in this game. Absolutely there will be.
Like, you have to keep in mind how heavy the characters are or you die.
So if somebody's playing
as Bowser, be on the other side of the board. I mean, this is the kind of... The people who are creating this game are way more creative than they get credit for sometimes.
Yeah.
And not just in the, hey, this is another item we could do, but just in the concept of how to be funny. The villager intro video is the same deal. He comes off as deranged in that video.
Oh, yeah.
The look on his face as he's running around with an axe. I mean, it's it took this really, I mean, one of Nintendo's most approachable, least unsettling, most, you know, most calm and tranquil franchises and turned him into an axe murderer. just with camera tricks, just by positioning the camera in exact right way. The people who make this game are way funnier than anybody you know. I mean, they're real funny. And
yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, like, what's great about the elements in Smash Brothers is they're funny on their own, but they're also funny when mixed together, even though they don't match up at all. And that becomes part of the comedy.
Right.
And it's amazing to me that they find certain combinations of things. And some of it is, you know, serendipity. But I think a lot of it, they do think through. They do give these people moves and they bring in elements from their games that they know will be funny when matched up against the other characters that they could potentially be playing against.
Oh, I mean, I'm fairly confident that things like Zero Suit Samus came out like, it'd be really stupid if she could transform into this blue leotard where she's effectively just lost all her powers, like it's an intro to a Metroid game.
Yeah.
It's like we're gonna strip her down like this is, I mean, I would laugh so hard if Mega Man occasionally just loses his powers in this game, which he probably will because it's part of the joke canon for that character.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I adore the comedy of this game, and I think that's part of the reason the For Fun and For Glory makes me laugh so hard. Like I'm in on a joke that the people who are excited about the For Glory mode don't get.
Hey, now I'm sure plenty of them are just as aware of what's going on as you are, James. But they're still happy that it's there.
That's fine, but I'm happy that he still got the joke in.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, I'm looking forward to playing it with all you guys online, hopefully, and maybe locally
or trying
sometime. Or try. We will certainly try. I can promise you that. Let's move on. And James, could you read the next email, please?
John writes, "I recently got involved in the early stages of development on a very small indie game for PC. Just for fun, I began looking around Nintendo's website for information on converting PC games to Wii U eShop games, and I was happy to see how inviting and straightforward they are with indie developers. It's no wonder so many small PC games are also coming to Wii U, despite not coming to any other home consoles. Mm-hmm. That being said, it seems obvious that your average gamer has no idea indie games exist. I regularly hear that there is nothing coming out for Wii U, but there seems to be a reasonably full schedule of indie games headed for the system. In fact, my most anticipated game of the year is a PC and Wii U game called Armacrog from the developers of Earthworm Jim and Neverhood. While Nintendo has done a great job of inviting the indie game developers, do you think they need to do more to let the average gamer know about these great games?"
Well, it just so happens we have an expert here on the panel today. I certainly have plenty of thoughts, and I've probably given them before, and I'll certainly give them again. But, Lewis, I would love to hear your thoughts on this. Are you concerned, excited, curious about the process by which Nintendo would promote your game if it is backed on Kickstarter? And if you get
it? Yeah, I think I'm more in that curious camp currently, because we've seen some of the indie games, you know, pop up in Nintendo Directs, whereas obviously some of them, if not the majority of them, obviously don't. But we do see nice promotions on the eShop. A lot of the time they use that kind of front store page rather well. And they will give some of the smaller games, you know, a decent size, you know, little picture box near the top of the page. And so on that side of things, it seems like they're doing a fair job. At least, I guess, as good as the competition, at least on the store side. But yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, there's obviously more they could be doing to actually tell people that, you know, we do in fact have more games. They are obviously on the eShop, and that doesn't just concern the indie games. That concerns their other stuff as well. But yeah, I think they should be doing, you know, everything they can think of to let people know about what is on the eShop and also the indie games as well. But I think managed to do an awful lot in terms of where they were, you know, back on the Wii days with WiiWare and the store they had on the Wii. They've obviously gone leaps and bounds since then.
Yeah.
But
in the wrong direction. I want more bad press releases.
No. I'd be okay with that as long as it was paired with the superior eShop. But, Lewis, I take it as a developer, you look at the eShop and see a place where you feel like your little tiny game would get a fair shot, you know, would get a chance to find an audience, and maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but it doesn't seem overwhelming to you, right?
It doesn't. I mean, it seems like, I mean, there are a lot of indie games coming, but as we know, it's not like the eShop is like swamped with an inflow of games every week.
Right. It's not like I mean, you come from the mobile development space where it's
a very different story.
Right. I mean, Nintendo is not culling the herd, but they're making sure the gates don't get blasted open by too many things at one time. Now, you can make an argument that that's self-defeating, that by if they were more constantly pumping things into the service, that it would be more attentively monitored by consumers. But at the same time, at the very least, you know that your game, if it's released on the eShop, is going to be mentioned in a press release that Nintendo themselves is sending out to thousands of members of the media.
Yeah.
Which,
And I mean, they've kind of gone out of their way to sort of cultivate this image for themselves that they care more about the quality of games rather than the quantity
of
games.
Well, yeah, I think that's...
I have a pretty sound counterexample to that I'm going to hold.
I think it's circumstantial for now, but... you know, I do feel like there is such, because the access has increased so much, there is a potential for a lot of bad games to fill up the eShop. It happened on Xbox 360 with their indie service. There were good games on there, but it was hard to find them because it was so easy to make those games, and people all around the world were doing it, and it was all getting thrown into one melting pot that was completely disorganized.
I would say 7 of the 10 worst games I've ever played. And I deliberately buy bad games. 7 of the 10 I worst played were on the Indie Arcade.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's
rough. Some of them,
and there's some fantastic stuff on there, believe it or not.
Some of them that were so bad that I couldn't even put words around them.
Yeah, so...
Mr. James, we're talking about.
But I do feel the eShop is so much more manicured than that, and I'm impressed when I go there at... You know, there's so many different tiers of content available on the eShop. You've got $60 brand new full price retail games that are 12 gigabytes for some damn reason. I'm looking at you, Donkey Kong. And you all the way down with
store
a lot
all those
of stuff,
bananas.
A lot of stuff in between, including like discounted older retail games. You've got $20 original eShop games. You've got $5 original eShop games. And you've got indie games being made by one or two people. And it's, to me, impressive that they've really got it all there in one place. You don't have to go digging through 5 levels of menus to find this stuff. They throw all of it out there on the front page, and they categorize it. And not only are they making it – they're floating things up to the surface where most people are not going to dig through the depths of the shop, right? Most people are going to look at the homepage. They either see something they want or they don't. But they're giving a lot of different kinds of content a shot at being exposed at that level. And the other thing is they're not afraid to get creative with the layout of the eShop because it's basically a web page. But so was the Wii Shop channel, and that thing could not have been more rigid. And they never got creative with it, and it was brutal to find anything. And the eShop, it's like every week it looks different. It looks more like one of those newspaper circulars you get for GameStop, where they show you all the newest games that they just got in and all the price cuts and the special deals on all the trade-in values and stuff like that. They print a new version of that every week, and it always looks a little bit different. And it's exciting to look at it and say, oh, what games are out this week? And the eShop has become very similar to that, I think.
I would say to that end, if you look at other regions' eShops, it's not just a matter of them having different picture icons. The layout of the eShop looks different. Like how they visually arrange the pieces of information on the screen is different because they have the flexibility to do that at a region-by-region level.
That's excellent.
And even beyond that, they do obviously the regional like sales and discounts.
Right.
I mean, we've had some sales over here in the UK which haven't come across to America, where you would buy two games and get a third free, and it would just be a completely localized thing, and it was really nicely advertised on the eShop itself.
Whereas I know in the US and Canada they've done more of these, like where they take a collection of games across the spectrum, you know, virtual console games, Wii U disc releases, you know, small indie games, large eShop games, mm-hmm. that all kind of tie around some loose theme, and they'll put an icon on the screen that then takes you to a sublist. It'll be like Games of Winter, and then there'll be a bunch of games that have snow themes in them.
Right, and they do that on 3DS as well.
Yeah. And
it's very smart.
That's totally regional from what I understand. It's just something that NOA likes to do. I know they've done it some in Europe, but I don't think they do it nearly as much.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I've ever seen the Japan eShop Roundup mention them doing that.
Yeah, also on the topic of sales, it's good that finally developers / publishers can set sales when they want. And a good example is RC Mariak's Block Drop U, which last week they dropped their price, which was already only $2, to $1 for just a week period. And he only had to give Nintendo 1 week notice to put that in place.
Nice.
And so they've, again, gone leaps and bounds to where they used to be. And they're a lot more flexible. So that fills me with a lot more confidence as well. If I want to do some sort of special promotion and drop it by a couple of dollars for a certain weekend or a week or whenever, I can do promotion around that. I don't have to be bound by the rules Nintendo have set upon me.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
I would say that to the end, though, of does Nintendo need to do more to publicize these games, I think they do a bit already. I mean, we talked about a lot of stuff they're doing. I mean, and like I said, can you imagine a $1.50 game getting mentioned in a press release from Microsoft?
Right. I mean, to me, the main thing that they do, it's not that they have like a special, they don't ghettoize the indie games. They basically treat them like all the other games. And that right. goes for the visual organization of the eShop as well. You can't necessarily tell what's an indie game and what isn't when you go there. And that's really the best, that's the ideal case for these indie developers. I mean, they want to be treated the same way, I would think. I don't want to speak for you, Lewis, but I would imagine you want the same treatment, you want the same shot as something that Capcom puts out for $15 or a virtual console game. You know, why not put it all out there and let people decide what is most attractive to them based on
right.
the artwork, the title, the price, whatever.
The description.
Yeah.
The reviews.
The press release.
I mean, yeah, God, the press release. I mean, every game gets its own space on Miiverse. I mean, that's...
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
Can you imagine if every game on PSN got its home space? Where you could, I mean, yeah. This doesn't happen.
Lewis, how crazy is it that you might have your own Miiverse community?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty crazy. And it seems that, obviously, you have a sort of spokesperson Miiverse account as well. So I have an authorized Miiverse account. I can let people know on Miiverse that, you know, I am the developer of the game, and I can give out news directly, as it were, to people if they're actually listening on Miiverse for that type of thing. But it's cool that they do, you know, give you those tools nowadays. I mean, even like the PS4 and Xbox One don't quite have that same sort of connection between developer and player, at least that I'm aware of.
So to that end, though, I would say that I know it's hard, obviously, to get coverage of your game if you're a one-person show. We have another friend of the show who is in the same process that Lewis is going through right now. They're working on releasing an eShop game on Wii U. And it's, you know, there are challenges, and one of the challenges is just getting attention for your game. And I mean, I know what you're doing here right now is you're going from place to place to drum up attention for this game that you are attempting to fund right now.
Yeah, there's a reason that bigger companies pay people to do this stuff. It's difficult and time consuming, and you can mess it up.
But you can it's do something it wrong. That you can't. I don't think indie developers are, but I'm just saying you can't rely on Nintendo to do it all for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
You've got to put in the legwork, because ultimately you have a bigger interest in being successful than they do in you being successful.
Yeah.
And that's not condemning anybody. That's just business.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Not from a cruel or cold way, but obviously they're interested in making their cut, as it were, or their money. Right. And so if my game's only going to be selling a couple thousands, but they can promote a different game instead, which is going to get tens or hundreds of thousands, then they don't have a real huge incentive to put mine as equal attention or more so. But it does seem that they are
not giving lip service. They're paying attention. I mean, Block Drop U isn't a huge game. I mean, it's a $2 game, and its name tells you what it is. I mean, they did a fairly significant amount of PR for that game. I mean, it was the first. Was it the first HTML5 game we had?
That I'm aware of, it was, yeah.
Yeah, I believe it was. I mean, and they didn't treat it like it was anything but another release.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in and of itself...
Very smart. because you want people to make those games. So you don't want to set a precedent of the first one comes out, they treat it like it's some kind of piece of crap, special thing. It's like a weird experiment. And then other people making these games are say, well, then we're not going to bother, you know?
And I think it plays into what they have said they're trying to do with the web framework, which I guess we haven't asked. Are you going to be using the Nintendo web framework for this project?
I am, yes. So it is running on HTML5 technically and JavaScript opposed to the Unity engine.
Right, which is another option they've opened up for relative approachability, as opposed to having to build your own game engine.
Mm-hmm.
That the Wii U will support Unity stuff, just for indie developers who want to just make Unity-based games, and it gives them a toolkit that they can say, look, you can use this, and we're not going to treat you any differently because you use this, even though we've much lowered the barrier of entry because of these tools. I mean, a game is a game is a game to us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not personally taking advantage of this, but I mean, what the web framework is perfect for is making these multi-platform games, can include the Wii U. Or if you've already made a game, you can convert something, even if it wasn't HTML5 to begin with, there's so many middleware tools now, you can convert that to HTML5, and then there's a certainty there that that's the web framework will run that on the Wii U. It's pretty robust. You only have to make a couple of tweaks here and there.
At the GDC where they first showed the web framework, I'm trying to remember who it was, but there was a fairly big middleware company who had a product that converts compiled iPhone 5 code, like compiled code, not source code, to HTML5, and like they were just showing it off, and somebody just had the idea of, hey, I've got an iPhone game that I made. Can we convert it and will it run on the Nintendo web framework? And it just did. They just converted it, dropped it on there, and it wasn't great. It needed optimization, obviously, but it just worked.
Well, yeah, and you probably couldn't control it either, but it was running on the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, weren't they able to do it there?
Yeah, they did it live. They did it on on the show floor.
That's gutsy.
Such as GDC has crazy. A show floor.
That's really cool that they did that. Yeah, I've heard that story before, I love it.
Will this work? And Nintendo's PR rep for the web framework was like, I don't know, let's find out. And it did.
That's awesome.
And everybody, I'm sure the guys in the back are like, oh my god, what is he doing? Who is this PR guy?
I'm trying to remember his name. It seems like there are a core group of people who web framework is their thing, and it's their project, and he was one of those, let's give it a shot, see what happens.
Well, you know, a lot of that stuff is being run out of Nintendo Software Technologies.
Right.
In Redmond, yeah, they used to do the Mario. Well, they still kind of do the Mario and DK series.
Right,
had one come out last year, so they're still active, but they don't make a lot of games. I think they mostly work on tools.
Yeah, and the fact it's being run out of there is probably a part of the reason you still can't do web framework out of Japan, which is a shame.
Right, it'll probably get there, but
this seems like this is Nintendo. NST or I mean NCL has sort of let the Western branches of their company do what they want to do and see what happens.
Finally,
which
smart,
which is a remarkable amount of freedom that they've let them have.
Right.
I mean, keep in mind that when Retro devs something, it's being monitored by NCL, not by NOA.
Well, the thing is, too, I think Nintendo recognizes that Western devs really like this kind of sort of quick hit development a lot more than devs in Japan. They're just with the explosion of iOS and Android and all that. I mean, they had to kind of address that in some way. And
there is a culture of that there in Japan, but it's a very different kind of game. It's when we talked about these kind of free to play with cash add ons, those are quite big there, but they're not really conducive to making a Wii U game.
Right.
Oh, I say that, but there's a Puzzle and Dragon 3DS game, so what do I know?
Yeah, which does not have microtransactions, though. That they built that in.
But, I mean, that is a competent puzzle game in and of itself.
Sure.
So it still works.
But I think we're really... It doesn't seem like much right now. It's more of a trickle right now. But I think we are actually within striking distance of a real wave of indie games coming out on Wii U. And it's probably going to happen this summer. And I don't know what the result will be. I don't want to make any predictions about, you know, how those games will do. Will it have probably not any major effect on Wii U sales or anything like that? But it might get more people talking about the system. It certainly will get more games out on the library, which is badly needed. And some of them might be really good. And it's been a long time coming. We've been talking about this since GDC a year ago. But a lot of these games are now like literally weeks away from coming out, including some pretty high profile stuff like Shovel Knight, which was another Kickstarter game and is getting talked about on, you know, on everywhere. I'm like, it's a game that people are super interested in. They've shown up at PAX and had very prominent appearances with that for a couple of years now. And that game is coming out on Wii U. And I think it is a very much an indie game made by a very small team of people who were literally funded by Kickstarter. So, you know, they're really going to set the example for a lot of other people to come. And we'll see how it does. But, you know, we've heard from, like, Renegade Kid from Jules saying that Mutant Muds actually has sold the best on Wii and 3DS of any of the platforms. And that's out on PS4 and PC and Vita now. And it's, you can get that game on anything, even iOS. But it has sold the best on Nintendo systems. So if, you know, if that's a real trend, if that's a real effect and not just a fluke, then this might be a really good thing for the system going forward. And I think we're really right on the cusp of it, of kind of the leading edge of it right now. And I think the next few months will tell us a lot about how the system will be an incubator for these kinds of games. The way that Vita is already seen, I think Wii U can be that and more. Because it's a console, it reaches people in a different way than a handheld, and it doesn't have some of the same stigmas that a handheld does, like being compared to phones. And I think if Nintendo pulls it off, it could be a big deal. Relatively speaking, for, you know, for how the system's doing now, it could be a nice boost, really. I think so. All right, so that's going to have to be our last email this week. We went long on some topics, and I'm very glad that we did. So we'll get to more next time. It does look like we're going to wait 2 weeks, I think, two more weeks to do Retroactive. I thought we might do it next week, but Guillaume is not sure that he'll be on the show. In fact, I think he won't be because he's staying in Boston a few extra days with his girlfriend. And good for him. He deserves a vacation. That guy works really hard on the show. So we'll find something to do next week. James and I will keep editing, unfortunately. And Lewis, let me know if you need a little extra work. Let me know, dude. No, but we will press on. We'll have another show for you next week and probably do some listener mail and maybe talk NPDs if there's anything to talk about. I don't know. But we'll find something. We always do. So please send in your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please participate in Retroactive. I got to play a little bit of GoldenEye last weekend. Had a blast just playing against random people, and it's even more fun when it's someone from the community. It does show your name up on the screen. So if you're playing one of us, I think you'll know. I think you'll recognize our usernames, and hopefully we'll recognize yours from TalkBack, from Gaff, Twitter, whatever. So please do add your friend code. Unfortunately, that's part of the process. It's an old game, and you have to put up with friend code. So there's the Retroactive forum thread is the perfect place to do it. Throw up your friend code, put in some other people's. Mine's up there, and hopefully John and James and Guy will be putting theirs up as well. And we'll try to organize some nights for everybody to get together, but also just, you know, let people know, put a post up in there and say, hey, I'm going to be playing Tuesday night. Hope you guys will jump on. And you might be surprised what happens, and I think you'll have a lot of fun with it. So do that. Let us know what you think, and we'll have a good Retroactive here in a couple of weeks. So that's it, folks. Thank you so much for listening. Lewis, thank you so much for being our guest, and best of luck with your game, Twisted Fusion. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being here.
All right. And, of course, you can hear more from Lewis on the Infendo podcast, which has like over 300 episodes. You guys are pretty legit. On the website, it says it's the world's number one Nintendo podcast. And I don't think I agree with that claim, but I'm sure it's worth checking out. So so go do that as well. We'll have a link to that as well in the show notes and, of course, to the Kickstarter. And I hope you'll check that out. But that's it for this episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next time.
Later.
original game was released before Mutant Muds on an iPhone. So if anything, they stole my idea.
Oh, nice. Throwing down the gauntlet. Well, we know Jules too, so we should check up with him, and maybe we can start a feud, game dev feud.
Well, definitely.
Tupac, yeah. And Biggie and Snoop, and
where are you going with this?
I'm trying to get John to say something, but he just sits
there. I don't
really
have much
stunned.
To say with that context. I don't know. Yay!
That's, hey, okay, that's a good start.
That's all I got.
That's pretty good.